It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Well, Andy Iannacco's here. So is Renee Ritchie. And Alex Lindsay stops by to watch me do a very foolish thing. I install High Sierra on the air live. But it works. It works. We'll talk about new iPhone rumors and a whole lot more. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 566, recorded Tuesday, July 11th, 2017. Ride my pipes for free. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Dollar Shave Club. For a great shave at a great price, join Dollar Shave Club. New members get their first month of the Executive Razor and a tube of Dr. Carver's Shave Butter for only $5 with free shipping. Get yours at dollarshaveclub.com/MacBreak. And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you could post to 100-plus job boards, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And by Drobo, a family of safe, expandable, yet easy-to-use storage arrays. Drobos are designed to protect your important data forever. Visit DroboStore.com to learn more and use the code TWIT10 to save 10% off select Drobos, including the new Drobo 5D3. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple. And hail, the gang's all here from Montreal, Canada, and iMore.com. Renee Ritchie, bearded, looking good. I like you in a beard.
I'm accidentally bearded, Leo. I just didn't have an opportunity to shave it.
That's how hairy he is. One day, and that's what he looks like, kids.
It's Canadian. It's defense against the elements.
It must be.
It's boom, Grizzly Adams.
Boom.
Sasquatch. Boom, Sasquatch, yeah.
Do you ever, you know how hickory bark can taste kind of like grape nuts? No, wait a minute. That's not right. Also, Andy Iannacco is here from the Chicago Sun-Times. Great
Hello.
To see you. And the Northeast.
Yes, we're defending the northern border. Apparently, it's now a thing.
Yes. Against us.
Against the White Walkers.
No, just to keep people from leaving.
Oh, okay.
Please, hang in there.
Please, don't give up. And also here, on a day after his birthday, Alex Lindsay joining us.
Hello, hello.
Hi, Alex. Good to see you.
Hey. Happy birthday.
Hey, happy, thank you. Belated happy birthday to you.
Yes, thank you.
Did you celebrate? Did you do anything fun?
I have to admit, I worked most of the day. I flew back from New York yesterday morning, and I worked right up until I drove home, but I did get to have a nice dinner and cake with my kids and my wife, so it was good.
I was so pleased when I came in this morning. I had a box from the UK, and it says Tailors of Harrogate, and I thought, wait a minute,
it's the new Cones of Dunshire.
Harrogate is in Yorkshire. You're close. It's the maker of my favorite tea, Yorkshire Gold. And apparently they're fans. And I just got look at this. This is the funniest thing I ever saw. You're going to love this. This Week in Tea.
There you go.
They sent me a giant box of Yorkshire Gold, which is my favorite tea. I mean, it really is a great tea. In Britain, it's divided between PG Tips and Yorkshire Gold fan. You must be a tea drinker because you're in Canada, right, Renee?
I do. I am a coffee drinker, but I also enjoy my teas. We have David's tea here that makes a ton of really good stuff.
Yeah. I love Taylor's of Harrogate, so I'm thrilled that they sent me this. And this is the funniest thing I ever saw, This Week in Tea. So
it's amazing.
Thank you, Tom. And then a little. I don't know what this is. Yorkshire.
What's your tea weapon of choice, Leo? What kind of tea?
My tea weapon of choice.
What tea do you like? What's your
Yorkshire Gold, which is a black. I don't like Earl Grey at all.
Okay.
Now this is their. This is some other stuff. This is the breakfast brew, which I will be trying. But this is, in my opinion, Yorkshire Gold is the best English tea.
I have not tried it. I've got to give it a try.
Oh, you gotta have that. So anyway, Tom.
I'm a big PG Tips myself.
Earl Grey gave us the Grey Cup, so he's at least redempted a bit.
I hate Earl Grey. Too much
PG Tips does have that association with Wallace and Gromit. You can get a Wallace and Gromit tea cozy. So
this has become the new This Week in Tea show. And look, they sent me, what is this? A tea towel. Literally.
The hard part is really finding good cozies. I mean, the cozies for the pots are the hard part, I think.
Yeah. I do it a cup at a time, and I use a tea ball. But I have a number of lovely pots. There's a tea company in the United States that does some really interesting teas. But I'm a simple guy. I just like my tea
on bag. My new tea poll list.
I had a transformative experience several months ago where I got a good deal on one of those really good like work job site like thermos vacuum bottles that holds boiling water like hot for like 3 days. And so now like every night I check to make sure that my thermos bottle is filled with this liter of piping hot water. I wake up and with my first conscious thought is to pour myself a cup of tea.
I love tea.
And now because I have this piping hot, the steaming hot cup of water like in my hands, that is my incentive not to fall back asleep again because otherwise I will kill myself.
So I get besides the Yorkshire Gold, if I want fancy stuff, I go to Adagio. And they have I like Adagio. They sent me, because I mentioned them once before, so I should mention that they gave me this, they call it the concert teapot. It's beautiful. It's highly impractical, although you see it has a little candle. But it's a solid glass teapot, and it really is gorgeous. I should have bought the extended warranty, though, because I immediately broke it. But
it's more practical than those fire-based vacuum infusers at Blue Bottle. So, you mean you're not...
Yeah, those are kind of kooky, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
They look hella impressive, but they're finicky.
Yeah, I think they... See, there's all sorts of ways to brew, and I really haven't ventured into the varieties of brewing.
I use the one where you put the tea in the leaves in the top, and then you put it on the cup, and it drains into the cup from above.
Yeah,
I
like
found
this.
Those very useful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tea travel infuser. Anyway, I don't know how we got into tea, because this is not a show about tea, but I just wanted to thank my friends at Taylor of Harrogate for sending me This Week in Tea, which is kind of
good lesson for everyone. We just made all of our tea equipment.
It will get a lot of people listening to it.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, Andy. I'm sorry.
No. I was just going to say that if we just say like what our favorite tea kettle is, what our favorite infuser is, we can make that tax deductible.
Tea is lagging behind coffee in terms of I have in my house 12 different ways to make coffee. Mm. We got to work on this with you, tea.
Tea
guys.
Only needs one, Leo.
It only needs one.
I think I only have 4 ways to make coffee in my house.
Remember that thing? It looked like I was making crystal.
I got
meth,
one of those.
The giant cold brew drip system.
Yep. I like a good Te Kun Yam also, and some silver leaf tea. Those are good too.
Yeah. Puer is my
tea. Puer, yeah.
Yeah.
Puer, very good.
Oh, wow. But again, I don't know.
The Japanese one with the toasted rice in it.
Yes, that's my favorite. Yeah. Love that. What is that called?
No, I'll have to double check the name. Ah, it's on the tip of my tongue. I'll double check.
They have that over across the street, and is it Genmaicha?
Yes.
I love that.
Genmaicha.
It's a green tea, but it has toasted rice in it, which gives us this nice toasty.
Yeah.
There is a certain pull to the This Week in Tea concept, I believe. Yes.
Get some VCs in the room and make it happen.
Yeah, really. Popcorn tea or roasted rice tea.
Do you dunk the biscuit or keep it dry?
I'm a dunker.
A crumpet? Yeah.
I'm a dunker.
Depends on the biscuit. Yeah. You have enough, crumpets. So you can do both.
Crumpets are the best.
I like a good digestive on the side.
By the way, why are crumpets not as big as scones and English muffins?
Because they're harder to make.
Yeah, they're harder, but they are
the
best.
Harder to make.
A crumpet
know,
is
really
so far better than anything else out there.
It's like Yorkshire pudding versus stuffing. It just takes more effort,
I
so
love
people
Yorkshire
don't do it.
Pudding.
Yeah.
Crumpets are made on...
Food Break Weekly.
I don't know what we're doing here. Crumpets are made on griddle. So you might say, English muffin. No, but that's probably what was inspiring the English muffin.
Yeah.
It has a wonderful...
There used to be a tea and crumpets in San Rafael that you could actually go get them. And there was like a little open window where you could see them making them.
I remember that.
So good.
I kind of had to stay away from them because I would have otherwise died of crumpet overdose.
Crumpet scurvy when you're not getting enough vitamins because you're eating nothing but crumpets.
too much crumpets. So we're all saying all this because really all we have is rumors today because Apple's been busy making the new iPhone. I have been playing with iOS 11. The new High Sierra public beta came out, I think, this week, if you wanted to try it. Renee, you're a big beta guy. I know you said don't use iOS 11, but I've been using it on my iPad Pro 10.5.
Well, don't put it on your main phone. Like, if it's a phone that you depend on for your life or your business, don't put it on that.
Yeah, of course not.
Your iPad is okay.
But on my iOS, on my 10.5 iPad, it just sings. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And we just did a whole bunch of tips on iOS 11 on iOS Today. And I learned some things because, I had split screen my Safari and I couldn't unsplit screen it. It is not intuitive. I'd had two panes, which is nice because Safari didn't used to be able to do that, but recently they added that ability. But then there was no way to close the pane in iOS 11. It turns out if you close all the tabs in one of the panes, then it will go away.
I just caution people because even like, let's say beta 3 is miraculously good, maybe beta 4 will have a big problem.
There's always
you're
that
on
risk.
That train. Yeah. So
let me ask you, because I'm very interested in getting APFS on my Macs. Should I go to High Sierra public beta?
So I put it on my, because I never listen to what I do, Leo. I put it on my main machine the day of WWDC. I did that with all the betas. And since then, I put it on two other Macs. I put it on my MacBook Pro, and I put it on a MacBook and an iMac. And the APFS was the easiest part of any of those. It's a little checkbox. You check it while you're doing the update. It changes your file system. And mine have been perfect. I reclaimed space. They're singing along. I don't recommend that people go and reformat their backup drives or their external drives because it works great with HPFS as well.
You don't need to.
With HFS as well, yeah. You absolutely don't need to. But for the main system, I've done it and I have zero regrets.
No noticeable showstoppers?
Nothing. In terms of APFS, no, I think they've really done their due diligence on it. That's not to say, you know, any one of us might be the first outlier or at least one of the first outliers. So do proceed with caution. Do have your backups done. Do have an ability to revert if you need to. But it's myself and everyone at iMore and everyone that I know who have done it have not even noticed that it was done, which I think is the biggest compliment you can ever give a file system.
But you can't get that new file system without getting High Sierra 2, right?
It was available as a beta for the previous OS, but at this point, you know, I wouldn't recommend anybody go back and run an old beta version.
No, absolutely not. So in other words, you're saying High Sierra's okay.
Yeah. I mean, the things that High Sierra are changing are really foundational things, and they've done really good work on that. It looks the same, so you won't have any worries about not knowing how it works. It's just a bunch of technological improvements.
It's like Snow Leopard. It's an incremental upgrade to Sierra.
It's one of those things that Apple does that I really, and I think we've talked about this before, but at Apple, there are some features that are pushed down from the marketing team, but there's a lot of features that are just like ProMotion. That was an engineer who came up with that idea and they went with it. And this was Craig Federighi, I think he said this on the talk show. He told the teams, if you had the time, what would you fix? What would you do to make your apps or your frameworks better? And they gave them, I think, 50% time to do that. And this is the result.
There are apps that have problems. Like if they're apps you need, they may not work with it, right?
But more and more developers are announcing at least preliminary support.
So I've backed up my Mac. Don't tell them I didn't. But I backed up my Mac. The next thing is to download the Mac OS public. First, you have to log in.
Yes.
And then download the Mac OS public beta access utility.
Yeah, so it's a little DMG file that you run, and it puts you on the beta track rather than the release track for the updates.
Okay. So let me run this.
Are we doing this live? Exciting.
I probably shouldn't do it.
You should do it on the Skype computer that's running this entire conversation.
Do you have a backup Surface nearby?
Yeah, if I have to, I can go to Windows. Okay, and then it wants me to log in.
It does
in.
Take a little while. It'll take about 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah, what a surprise. I mean, you're actually changing the file system. And then once you run that little stub, which I've done, now you get pulled to the store where you can see Mac OS High Sierra, your Mac elevated, and the button is now says download.
Yeah, they've made it much easier because it became a public beta. It's no longer all the hoops you had to jump through for developer beta. Yeah. They've really streamlined the process.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So is there somewhere a list of the apps that don't work?
I haven't seen one, but I haven't looked for one because I've literally not run into a problem. I'm running, you know, Photoshop and Tweetbot and almost everything
thing.
I've ever run.
So the Adobe stuff runs. That would be, for me, a showstopper. I guess everybody knows what they need.
Every once in a while, I get like the app shuts down and do I want to send it to developers? But then I pop it back up and it works again.
Oh, okay. They fixed it already.
Yeah. Or at least I don't think there's such differences that it made a huge impact on developers.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the problems of running beta software, though, because whenever I'm running a beta OS and something weird happens or something crashes or something won't start up, I will stop diagnosing it because I'll think, oh, well, this stupid beta, oh, well. Without knowing that, no, it's probably maybe my network is down, or no, maybe this one app is crashing, or it kind of lowers your guard for a little bit.
And then once you install this, you will automatically get updates now, right? I don't have to. If I go to the App Store, it will show up as an update.
Yes. Oh, and I should say that if you're using a lot of apps, like maybe like the Rogue Amoeba apps that do a lot of low-level things on stuff like on Foundation or Core Audio, those might be more problematic than if you're running vanilla software that just uses Apple's frameworks.
All right.
I don't know that for sure, but I know that they're updating a lot of stuff. So.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to do it now. Although I'm mightily tempted.
I'll do it in 5 seconds when I can't help myself.
mightily tempted. All right. Well, good. So it doesn't sound like there's a lot of reasons to avoid it. Obviously, if you're Alex Lindsay and you've got massive business issues, that if these Macs aren't reliable and you use a lot of software, right?
Well, and I'll probably update. I have a computer at home that I'm probably going to update just to go ahead and play with it. I did that with I got the new iPad Pro and immediately just decided I'm just going to throw on the beta to start with rather than worrying about anything historical. I have another iPad that I can jump back to. But
I'm kind of glad I put it on my Pro because it really is made for that. You know,
one of the coolest things is that they're, and this won't impact almost any user, but one of the coolest things is they did a lot of work to optimize their VR pipeline, for example. So they'll get everything out of the way, all the CPU stuff out of the way, and let the computer hit the GPU as much and as fast as possible. And they've got this wicked cool diagnostic stuff too. So you can do like eye-by-eye comparisons to see what's going on with your code if you're developing stuff for VR. And there's a lot of really clever stuff in their developer tools now as well.
Apple,
it's really geekily impressive,
may become the first $1 trillion company this next 12 months. This is according to a Wall Street analyst, Brian White, who unbelievably says Apple's stock is undervalued. He says, buy more. Uh-oh. To set up the installation. No, don't.
Do you want to, Leo? Can you?
Do it.
No, because then if I do it, then I won't have access to my machine for, what, 15 minutes?
All the cool hosts are doing it.
Yeah, all the cool hosts do it.
You know. Sierra's not high, Leo? It's not fully baked.
Alex and I are doing it right now. I don't know. Hey, not everybody has that kind of guts, but I mean, you know, that's fine. You be you, Leo.
Oh, you're so
the cool host to it on
hand. Rassin.
Back to Brian White, who says Apple remains among the most underappreciated stocks in the world. How can you say Apple stock is underappreciated? He says,
I mean,
in our
it's
view,
kind of true.
Is it? He says, in our view, Apple's quarterly results will be less important this summer as investors are focused on the iPhone 8 this fall. That's for sure true. Along with the company's raised capital distribution initiative, depressed valuation.
They've always been under, I mean, like Amazon has always been super valued based on the profits that they make, and Apple's always been very low valued.
Price to earning ratio. Yeah. Okay. And new innovations as showcased at WWDC. So some of this is probably augmented reality, right? The Scoble effect that people are
AR
saying.
What is the right finger, though, Leo? That's my question. Like, I know a billion is the pinky, but what is it for the, like, is it the whole hand
trillion
for a trillion?
$1 trillion. Wow, he says.
Especially when you look at I think that Apple's, their PE ratio, I think, was much higher before. $4 more, I think, or four. Only a couple years ago. So it is definitely less than it has been and definitely less than a lot of other companies in the same group when you look at their actual PDE ratio.
So, and we should say this, we don't make stock recommendations on this show. I'll speak for myself.
We have no idea what we're doing when it comes to that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I didn't want to speak for you guys. No. Price to earnings on Apple's, it's not small. It's 17. That means that the stock price compared to their earnings, but of course, Amazon's used to be in the hundreds, right?
Yeah.
Right now, it's $145. This analyst says it's going to break $202 over the next 2 months, which would make it a $2 trillion company. It's currently valued. Let's see what the current value.
We should also remind people
that $759
billion. And to put it in perspective, I mean, Amazon is
203 for Amazon, yeah.
Right now,
Price to earnings. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And investing is sort of like legalized gambling, so we should just factor that.
Yeah.
It's really a bunch of speculation and human human.
Don't listen to
engineering.
Us. And if you're going to listen to advice, don't take it from us.
Yeah, definitely not. And my wife always says you should invest, and I'm like, then I can't be on the show.
So one of the reasons,
I think you got to whenever a piece of information comes from an analyst, you got to know how will it benefit this person if everybody does what he or she says. Right. So that's why. Interesting trivia, but oh well.
Yeah. So let's talk about the iPhone 8, because I think if this analyst and probably everybody else who's highly bullish on Apple is expecting a very exciting new release. One of the rumors coming from not just Ming-Chi Kuo, who of course has great sources in the supply chain, but now Mark Gurman is saying the same thing. It may be that the high-end OLED bezel-less iPhone won't have Touch ID.
That's the sound of shock.
That sounds like half of a story. That sounds like someone knows that the sensor that they were expecting to see is not there. But which is not to say that Apple has not put Touch ID someplace else, or they have not replaced it with something that they think is just as good. But I can't imagine what that could be. So
the rumor is that they have tried putting the fingerprint reader in other places and not been happy with the results. However, what Apple will do, and actually this sounds very Apple-y, is put in 3D sensing for facial recognition. We know that these cameras will have more capabilities. And iris scanning, and that they're of the opinion this is more secure than a fingerprint. It would have to be.
That's a very Samsung-y sort of way to approach authentication. It kind of ignores the fact that Touch ID is something that you can activate while you're just basically moving your phone into position. If they can do real 3D face sensing, it'll be a breakthrough for such a device. If they can do iris scanning in such a way that it's not, what time is my flight? Align, target, widen eyes, look, hold. Well, my plane is on time. That will also be unprecedented in this space. I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah.
So the thing,
I mean, I think that more people will use the 3D facial stuff for selfies and their Snapchat stuff than they will. I mean, if you think about what it will do to selfies, I think it's going to be more impactful to people buying the phone, is they'll suddenly have a 3D of the phone. And if we thought that the tracking was good before, just imagine how good it's going to be when we've got a 3D version of your head.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, Renee. Poor Renee has not been able to.
No worries. The way I look at it, at least, is that Apple has finished this. Like, as far as hardware is done, this phone is finished. They're not lingering at the, you know, trying parts in like Lego. So this phone is done. The only question, we are 3 to 6 months behind Apple. Like, they literally live in the future because they're working on the next 2 or 3 iPhones. So we're just trying to figure out, based on the information we have, which one of those options they chose. Now, their goal was to get the most infinity of infinity displays onto this phone, like as much glass and as little bezel as possible. And that meant changing the way Touch ID worked, because it just wouldn't work with a screen like that. And they've tried technology that works under the phone, and maybe or maybe not that worked. And they tried putting it on the back, and maybe or maybe they didn't like that. But Touch ID is just a feature. It's not a thing unto itself. It doesn't have to be there. It was one way to solve making authentication more convenient, because it's not really security. It's more of a username than a password. And if they feel like they can do what they said is a better, they can get more points of identification off of 3D scanning than they can get off a fingerprint, their job is evangelism. The same way people were dubious about Touch ID in the beginning, they'll be dubious about face scanning in the beginning. But they have to solve several problems to make this work. This is not an easy technology either. Samsung famously makes you choose between iris scanning and face scanning at the beginning, and one works in low light and one works in bright light, and one can be fooled by photos and the other one can't be fooled by photos. And that's a tough problem to solve. But Apple is uniquely positioned as a company that has a lot of resources and has full control of everything along the stack to sort of bring that sort of technology to market, the same way they did with Touch ID when the previous sort of generation of fingerprint scanners weren't really ideal either. So if they did, in fact, go with facial scanning because Touch ID wasn't workable, it's just because they believe that it's just as good, if not better, a solution. And the biggest question to me is, like, do you get banks and credit unions to go along with it without ever seeing it work in the real world or being tested in the real world, saying, okay, yeah, we're fine with Apple Pay anyway. We trust you guys to do this. Or do we have to wait, you know, until it's been on the market for several months before they get back on board?
And Andy and I both know that Touch ID on the back works, or fingerprint reading on the back works quite well on Google's phones, but that doesn't mean Apple would necessarily like it. It's not that it wouldn't work, but as you said, quite,
well, this could
quite
be better.
Accurately
phrased. It could legitimately
phrased.
Be better.
Yeah, and that would be the thing. Yeah. So right now, the face recognition we've seen, and Microsoft has it with Windows Hello in some of their systems and other people using Windows, and Samsung has it in their Galaxy S8. The ones we've seen are slower.
Yes.
And you have to position the phone properly.
I believe they're 2D. I'm not sure if they do 3D.
They don't
use
the same technology. Yeah. That's right.
They use a combination of regular cameras on infrared to basically trying to fool static photos. That's
right. Although we know that the Samsung Galaxy S8 has been spoofed, both of the iris
Apple
and
one is
the face scanning.
The Apple one is supposed to do points of identification the way a fingerprint does, and then also do it in milliseconds, which is way faster than I think a lot of them.
So that would be the two issues, of course. It has to be at least as secure, preferably more secure than fingerprint, because Apple Pay relies on it. And it has to be as convenient and as fast or faster, which means you shouldn't have to. With the Galaxy S8, you have to position the phone. In fact, they even put little eyes.
Right. Supposedly doesn't. This one, you could do it on a table, apparently.
Would be the key,
do
right?
Various angles
it
of
It just
detection.
Knows
yeah.
it's me, and it, you know, I don't have to do anything. It just knows. And that would be better than fingerprint, because I wouldn't have to do anything. It would just know. Right.
Well, and I also think that there's an opportunity. I mean, if they included fingerprint or iris or a backup, almost a two-part authentication with these biometrics, you could theoretically not necessarily be forced to do it this way, but have the option of saying, I want to know that my watch is on, that, you know, I'm in vicinity, you're going to look at my face. And I mean, and there are some people that would really prefer to have all of those things added to it to make it, you know, very, very secure.
Right.
And as you get to a point where you really feel like it's really working, like right now, I still have time, a handful of times when I need to actually still use my keypad rather than my fingerprint. When you feel like it's rock solid, you could theoretically either make a much longer keypad entry or get rid of it.
So here's Mark Gurman's quote. So Ming-Chi Kuo, you'd expect to know something because he has good supply chain sources, and as you pointed out, Renee, the phone's done. Are they making it yet? Probably, right?
I think they're for order. Yeah, they're going to start getting component orders in.
Yeah, so they're tooling up. The factories are tooling up. Prototypes exist. So it wouldn't.
But you've
be
got
surprising.
To program against that hardware. Like, you can't just keep moving hard. And again, I might be totally wrong. There might be people laughing at me at Apple right now, but I believe you can't. You can't just keep changing the hardware and expect the software team to catch up.
Yeah,
they'd end ship a product.
So here's Gurman's quote. He says they're testing face recognition. The company's also testing eye scanning to augment the system. The sensor's speed and accuracy are focal points of the feature. It can scan a user's face and unlock the iPhone within a few hundred milliseconds, the person said. Gurman has really good sources, so, you know, consider that. It's designed to work even if the device is lying flat on a table rather than just close up to the face. We got to explain to Mark the difference between laying and lying, but that's okay. Lying flat on the table.
Bloomberg editors.
Yeah, Bloomberg at least. Yeah. No, they don't have, nobody has copy editors anymore. The feature is still being tested and may not appear with the new device. That's an important sentence. A number of people sent me that or tweeted me that when I first reported this story. They said the feature is still being tested and may not appear with a new device. However, the intent is for it to replace the Touch ID fingerprint scanner. Apple, of course, refuses or declines. Not
it,
refuses,
it would have to be there, though. I mean, like, you can do something like enabling a feature like portrait mode after you ship it, but you can't go in and retroactively put the sensor in the case.
Yeah, yeah. The hardware. This is hardware stuff as well as software. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't mind if it's fast. And maybe this would only appear on the high-end OLED iPhone, and the other ones could continue to have Touch ID.
Yep. It would certainly fit in with all the infrastructure they're putting in for VR and 3D anyway. So it's possible that they have the system that's not just for authentication down the road, but also if you're doing augmented reality, it's very, very handy to know. I know that the plane of the phone is like this, but is the person's head like this? Are they looking over this way? Are they looking over that way? Are they looking towards this part of the screen? What part do I need to pre-render? There's a lot. Anytime Apple has a rumor about a new thing, my thought is always, yes, they're talking. Yes, the we're all talking about authentication, but what else could this infrastructure be used for in the next year's version of the OS or 2 years later down the line? It's also I'm just saying that I haven't seen it ever been done on that kind of a level where I've seen it done, and I've seen it even in labs being done well enough that you'd use it for a week. We need a solution where you will be using it a year from now, just like we're using Touch ID a year from now.
I think this makes sense that we're getting close to that. It does make sense.
We're getting close to it. I'd be surprised. I'm not saying it's not going to happen. I'm saying I'd be surprised if it happens this year. I will have learned something brand new, which is always a very, very good thing. Also, to be fair, as much as we like Touch ID, it has its own problems. Such as, like, in the winter when my fingertip is really, really dry, I have to tap a few times to get it to work. If in the wintertime where I'm wearing gloves, I have to take off a glove to get it to work, and that's when I switch over to. Yeah, so it's not as though the fingerprint ID is 100% either. So anything that if we can get it to a place where we can absolutely trust it, the first time where I can say I'm going to enable this feature on my phone and trust that someone who finds this phone and says, oh look, there's that Return of the Jedi sticker on the back of it. This must be Andy's phone. I wonder if we can find a photo of Andy and get access to the immense riches that a journalist has access to.
His MacBook picture is so HD. Well, I wonder if I can unlock it by watching the podcast.
There is a rumor that will cost $1,200 for this top
or more.
Line, or more.
Yeah.
Well, I think that one of the things that I think that a lot of those wow features will sell a lot of units. I mean, I think that Apple has proven that those higher price ones do pretty well. I think that I agree with Andy that I think that these being able to look at your face, for instance, if you think about what the facial recognition might be able to do is it also, if it's tracking those points and it tracks them over time, you could have an avatar that maybe looks like you, maybe looks like something else. But when you hold up your phone to talk to someone, they would theoretically see, you know, that avatar talking, you know, like really tracking your, I mean, you can do that with video cameras now, but you give it a little 3D information and you can get really accurate about how that avatar looks and how it acts. And I think that part of the bezel-less process is really Apple's commitment to the AR area, because that's going to create like a little window into something else. And the minimum number of distractions, I think, is really important to the design and the process that I think they're fairly serious about. If we look at, you know, what they chose to show at WWDC.
$1,200, I would pay that if it's, you know, too. Super cool. And
what do we pay for our watches, Leo?
Yeah. You know, I mean, really, I think that the Apple market is not that price sensitive. And if you have something special that only a few people can get.
It's limited in supply. It's super supply
constrained. That's my point. Exactly. Yeah. Right.
There's just a balkanization effect. As much as I think that we should make fun of Apple for doing a $12,000 solid gold gadget watch, we can at least say that the owners of the $12,000 solid gold gadget watch can't do anything with that watch that the owners of the $350 plain metal gadget watch can do. It would bum me out if Apple said the innovation is we're not really so much for the poors. We want to make the people with no sense of
very
money the happiest of all. So that would worry me.
I think there's an argument though for Apple to say, you know, we're going to make something available, you know, there's something available at a lower price point that you just can't simply do at that.
It costs us that much to make it, in other words.
You know, or to make now, like to not have to wait a year or 2 years.
Well, and look at the $10,000 iMac Pro that's coming out at some point.
Well, I think they test things too. Like they did the iPhone 5C, which they wanted to see what they could do with something that's unabashedly plastic, whatever. They wanted to make a lower price point one. And now there's probably some frustration at Apple saying, we want to do all these things, but we manufacture at such volume that we have to be able to get yield rates and source all these parts. And and this stuff is just not ready. But if we only do it in this much, and if we could charge this much for it, we could do it now today, and that would help us get this technology like the MacBook did, like the MacBook Pro did. It helps us get that technology into the mainstream version of the phone maybe 6 months or a year earlier.
That's what Elon Musk did with Tesla, right? He had very high-end models.
He started with the coupe.
To fund
I think that the issue is that a lot of what you're paying for when it first comes out is the R&D costs as well. You're not just paying for – they always break these phones down and say, well – the margin was massive. Well, the margin that doesn't take into account how many weren't working, and you know the 40% that go back because something isn't working,
and the 10,000 engineers it took to build it,
and also just
not to mention a couple of bucks to Qualcomm.
Getting panels for this is hard. Like getting for Samsung and Apple both to put out that many OLED panels is hard.
That's why this is going to be in short supply in all likelihood is the panel, right? The OLED.
The panel screen. And some of the other technology inside it.
I'll tell you those. Well, you tell me if I'm wrong, but people have used OLED screens compared to Apple's IPS LCD screens. Love them, right? They're better.
They have considerable advantages. I mean, there's like Andy said before, no technology is perfect. I know a bunch of people with OLED screens that have Pokeballs permanently burned in the bottom of the display now. And that doesn't happen with LCD. So
it seems like that's a thing for you to bring up with your addiction, Renee. Not for you to bring up with Samsung.
I mean, it's just, I was with a group of people and they were all complaining. And I'm like,
I know
really,
a lot of people have
track
mucks up and down their arms. I mean, the quality of these syringes.
I have never experienced burn-in. Really?
If you search Reddit, like there are people who use the same app or play the same game repeatedly that has the same pixels. And the Apple Watch is susceptible to this too. Like some people have complications that are just there so constantly that they can see the shadow of them. So it's a minor thing now, but it's like none of these technologies are perfect. And Apple for a while just wasn't happy with OLED. Now they're happy with it, and maybe it'll all be quantum dot 3 years from now or whatever, or micro LED 5 years from now. But yeah, LEDs, the advantages to it now overweigh whatever drawbacks they believed in previously, except for availability, of course.
Well, is there a way to fix OLED burn-in?
You just, don't keep that Pokeball on that screen so much. Stop playing it. Put it down. Walk away from your phone. Do something else.
That's a pretty extreme thing. Realize that a lot of OLED handset makers actually have like persistent display technology built into it, and that even when it's just a clock with moving numbers, I've actually done stupid things like I'm reviewing a phone, I'm done with the review, I left it on the charger, and then a month and a half later, it's time to send it back. I said, "Oh, that's right. I wonder what happened to the screen, and it's still not burned in, or there still isn't any fogging." So I don't think it's a real huge problem. But I say that if you've got game icons, it's like you need to think about your relationship with that game.
There's some widget burn-ins too and stuff. It's things that are really persistent on your display. Like this guy's got the HTC clock.
Us paid over $1,000 for our iPhone 7 Plus. I mean, it's not that much more. $1,200. No.
What if it's titanium?
Oh, yeah. If they make a ceramic phone, I mean, I don't care if it costs $5,000.
Is that I'm spending more money on my iMac or my computer, and we say that's more powerful, but I spend far more time on my phone than any other piece of electronics.
Right.
So the idea of investing more money into the thing that I use the most and I get the most out of, to me, seems fairly reasonable.
Should point out that the iPad Pro 10.5 they just put out with its new chip is so fast that I want to see that in an iPhone as well, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's massive. And
augmented
reality might be able to use whatever this depth sensing camera, that would be important for augmented reality as well.
What's super interesting about that chip, though, is like that I believe that is a 10 nanometer process we're seeing for the first time
10,
on the
really?
A10X. Yeah, and it's an A10X, so it's still based on the architecture of the A10, where with the iPhone, we'll be getting A11, which should also be 10 nanometer, but the next generation architecture as well. So I want to see how much of a screamer that thing is.
Wow.
Well, and the one thing I will say, we're doing a lot of AR work right now, and the one thing that becomes a big deal is battery power and heat dissipation. All of these phones, when you start doing a lot of, when you're using AR a lot, the battery burns out very quickly, and the phones get very... very hot.
Apparently, according to Digitimes, the chip maker TSMC started production of the A11 in April.
I don't know if you guys saw it or not, but there were people in Arizona with ice packs on the back of their phones. They were walking
were they really?
Yeah.
It was 120 it was just so hot. Or something last week. All right, let's take a little break. There's lots more to talk about. We are now enjoying our audience members, those who want a little Tailors of Harrogate, again, thank you, Tom. We're having the...
I'm sorry. I cannot hear that name without thinking of some sort of role-playing game going on.
It does sound like that, doesn't it?
There's some sort of 17-sided dice being rolled.
We're having the breakfast edition because it is before...
There's a dragon in the room. It's got fire breath right now.
Our show, we got a brand new sponsor. Want to welcome, a venerable... member of the internet community. I think these are the first guys to really take advantage of e-commerce. Dollar Shave Club. And I'm going to tell you a secret. I've been a Dollar Shave Club customer for a very long time. When they first started years ago, Remember that great video of them wandering through the plant? I immediately signed up for Dollar Shave Club. And we're really glad to have them as I think this is the first time, though, they've ever sponsored Twit. I, of course, immediately switched to my Dollar Shave Club executive razor. By the way, that is a nice-looking handle. And you get, of course, with the Dollar Shave Club, it's the smarter choice. You get the blades. Really, I have not seen a test, but I want to do a test. I think these are the sharpest blades I've ever used. And I think you want a sharp blade because there's less pull and drag on your beard. Sharp means you get cut less, not more. Anybody who has good knives knows that. A dull knife is the most dangerous knife in the house. Sharp blades, of course, they've got all the features you're looking for in a blade. They pivot. They've got the lubricating strip. They've got that extra sixth blade on the back so you get up under your nose there, which I absolutely have. Dr. Carver's shave butter. I love the shave butter. This is awesome. You put on, they say, a silver dollar size dollop. It's clear, which is at first takes a little getting used to because you expect a shave cream to be white, like you're supposed to look like Santa, like Renee Ritchie here.
Like I do.
Who obviously hasn't seen a razor in a few years. But it's clear, but it does, actually, transparent's not so bad because you can actually see where you're going, for one thing. But also, it is, it not only lubricates and makes it easier to cut the blade, but it does something special so that afterwards your face feels great. I'm not surprised. It has some really nice stuff in here. Dollar Shave Club. Make the smarter choice by joining Dollar Shave Club. Of course, razor blades, mail order. That's the key to this. And the $5 starter is, it's worth $15, but it's a great start. You get the executive razor. You get the full-size Dr. Carver's shave butter. And you get four blades and free shipping. And then a few bucks a month, and you're going to keep fresh blades all the time. And that's the important thing. I think when you subscribe, it gives you incentive to change that blade every week so you always have a sharp, clean shave. The weight and the balance on the handle is phenomenal. It feels great in your hand. After your first month, replacement cartridges ship automatically at their regular price. There are no hidden fees, and there's no commitment. Cancel anytime you like. Or put it on hold if you're going to be out of the country or whatever. And I don't think they get enough credit, frankly. Because when I get my my box, I love, they got the bathroom minutes. I love this. It is a little newspaper. It's just full of good stuff. Like, you know, sunburn treatments. It's all topical, right? Trivia, stuff like, it's fun. And great quotes. Like L.M. Montgomery on the back. I wonder what it would be like to live in a world where it was always June. This is the June edition, obviously. We'll get the July edition in a little bit. So, my friends, special offer for you, but you only can get it in one place. DollarShaveClub.com/MacBreak. DollarShaveClub.com/MacBreak. Get your Dollar Shave Club. Get your Dr. Carver Shave Butter. Get your handle. Just $5. And you do want the executive. It just feels nice. I love it. DollarShaveClub.com/MacBreak. We thank them for their support of MacBreak Weekly. We welcome them as a brand new sponsor. I want to get Taylors of Harrogate in here as a sponsor. We could have a tea break. Tea Break Weekly. All right. So more rumors. Oh, man. Apple beta software program. Install macOS High Sierra. It's still teasing me.
You know you want it.
I want it so bad.
Just hit it. Just hit the button.
Maybe I could just start a long...
Nothing's going to happen that you don't want to happen, Leo.
I should start a long conversation that so that not using my... too bad. I pressed agree. Oh.
You can take Sierra higher.
Oh. You've
made your first step into a larger world.
Upgrade Macintosh.
Should I? Oh, you want to check this box. That is not checked by default. Upgrade to the APFS. You save room, but more importantly, you use your SSD more efficiently, more reliably. It does a lot of wonderful things for usability. Reliability, data reliability. It does snapshots and backups and all sorts of stuff. 21 seconds from now, my computer will restart and I shall begin.
And it's smart for, on the one on the Mac is smart for mobile time machine and a bunch of other things. That's the new time machine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
it was originally given out and then stopped because it wasn't reliable, and now it works again.
Now I know nothing about the show. We're just going to have to wing it from here on in.
Do charades.
We were talking more about, let's talk more about the, oh, look at this. Lisa's showing off for you, Andy. She's decided she loves her Olympus OMD camera so much, she just started to upgrading her lenses.
You're killing me.
I know.
Come Scott Bourne is now switched over to that platform too. He's nothing but pictures from that $3,000 300 millimeter lens.
If I could show you the pictures from that, I would. The eagle images. So it's 300 millimeter, but that's effective 600 on a Micro Four Thirds lens.
Oh God! I thought I was done buying lenses, and now I'm like, oh, I really want that lens. There was a hawk right outside my kitchen window like this morning. I put it on Instagram, but I got my unfortunately only like really expensive middle range Olympus zoom on it, and it's like,
need 600. This is another pro lens. Lisa just bought the 40-150, which is effectively
80-300. That's mine.
What's surprising? With all of that, it's still pretty light and comfortable, right?
See, there are a lot of advantages to like the Sony system because it has a larger sensor for a lot of reasons. But when I look at the size of the lens that for the Sony system that does the same job, the same quality as that Olympus lens, I can throw that into a little hip bag and be walking around New York or walking around Boston with this amazing killer assortment of lenses. But with a Sony kit, I would have to really have a bag with me, and I'd have to really look like, hi, yes, I'm with the press.
DSLR, man.
It's really true. If you think that's bad, I'm shooting with a Canon.
There you go. Literally.
It's like a Canon. It's huge. That is so nice and light. Oh, and it's so fast. They've really done a nice job. Yeah, Scott Bourne has become the... In fact, we're going to get Scott on. He was on Twit last week. He's an Olympus ambassador now. The reason Scott, one of the, as Alex knows, the original members of MacBreak Weekly, the reason Scott had to switch is his doctor said, if you keep carrying that big, heavy Canon 5D and all those lenses around, your back's going to go. Mm-hmm. So he had to switch to a lighter camera. And, of course... this is a guy who shoots wildlife photography. You think you're not Micro Four Thirds. You're not going to get the detail. This is going to be a very disappointing experience to you. But he went out, got the OMD EM1 Mark II, which is what I was just using. That's what Lisa has. And the detail he's getting in his images. And the thing is, he has a picture on his page, scottbourne.com, B-O-U-R-N-E, of a eagle catching a fish in the water. And it's coming straight at him. He said, I could not get that with any other camera because that's the tracking focus. And he said, that's the hardest thing to do is something moving straight at you at high speed. And the detail and the focus is phenomenal.
Yeah. Especially in the hands of someone like Scott who absolutely knows what he's doing.
I want to lesson.
But it absolutely shows you that if someone says, oh, well, you can't do serious sports photography unless you have this camera, or you can't do serious nature photography unless you have this other camera. It really is. You can make almost anything work.
That said,
there's a certain I don't think that a Micro Four Thirds camera could have done that 3 or 4 years ago.
No.
It's the newest generation. It's like that is typically the complaint about Micro Four Thirds, that, oh, well, it's not fast enough for sports photography. And I'm shooting roller derby without focus tracking.
Your shots are great. I know. And Alex, I mean, I would imagine the Panasonic G5 would be of interest to you. That is a camera that shoots 422 video in the camera.
Yeah, we're definitely looking at it for a couple different reasons. So,
what do you use now? Do you use the Blackmagics
for video? We'll probably announce it sometime soon. We're going to kind of do a big sale of a lot of cameras. I was talking about.
And you're going to tell me first, right?
Exactly. I just want to copy, edit, and proofread your ads before you embarrass yourself.
You're not going to publicize it till you tell me.
You guys will get the picky.
But what are you dumping?
We're pretty much getting rid of all the video cameras that aren't Blackmagic. So we're that took us a long time to kind of get to. But the problem really is that trying to manage a lot of different systems has just become this thing. We've got Canons and Sonys and Panasonics, yeah.
And you can't, you know, they don't color match very well, right? Each manufacturer has different color styles, and
they don't, even different lenses look a little bit different, yeah. You know? And so you end up in this situation where we had to kind of decide what we're going to use. The way the Blackmagic stuff works, I can literally change the color of a camera from 3,000 miles away the way we have it set up in our system. And so, you know, I can, you know, we can, we have a lot of control over them, and we've got a lot of other cameras. We are keeping this. So we have we have Canon ME200s, which are low light cameras that we'll probably keep those because they are a very specific niche for us, being able to shoot low light. And the rest of them we're probably, you know, we've got a bunch of, we've got Sony F23s and P1s, and we've also got, you know, a lot of FS100s and a lot of other things.
My son is studying videography. He just got out of college and wants to do videography. So that's why I want to get on that list. Because yeah. And if you can recommend a good one for somebody starting out.
Well, I've been trying to figure out the best one.
He's doing ENG stuff. He wants to get around. He's not studio.
Yeah, and we don't have a lot of – we realize we have some ENG, like an EX1, EX3 kind of stuff.
It stands for electronic news gathering. It's, you know, people running around, running gun with cameras.
Yeah, and so we don't have – what we realize is we actually don't have a ton of ENG stuff other than using the Blackmagic stuff. So we use the – you know, we have, I think, I don't know, 10 or 12 of the Ursa Minis. And so those are kind of our – the ones that we use the most for, you know, for that type of thing. Yeah. And again, we're also trying to move all of our cameras, all the Blackmagic cameras that we have that we're going to keep are all 4K. So we're, you know, kind of
everything slowly will be 4K or better.
Yeah. Yeah.
And some are 5K, right? The new ones are 5K.
The Ursa Minis that we have are 4.6. Wow. So they're not quite five. Yeah. Wow. But, and we may keep the Reds cause we have an underwater rig for them. The Scarlets may stay.
Can you believe we are at a stage now where people are discarding the Scarlets for the next next thing that's new and better?
Well, it's what's exciting about it right now is that you don't try to keep a camera for 10 years because you were able to pay it off much faster, or get your value out
of
it.
A lot less expensive.
I mean, it's, you know, now the lenses are still expensive. I just bought some really painfully expensive.
But you can reuse the lenses, can't you?
The lenses are, you know, they're PL mount or they're a EF mount or whatever you're going to use. Those kind of things stay for a long time and they're durable and you can keep them.
That's kind of what's become in digital photography, still photography as well, is you buy good glass, but you're going to replace the body as this new technology.
Well, that was always, to some degrees, I would say that's always been the case for photographers, is they're constantly moving their bodies up and they're constantly spending a lot of money on glass because that's really what's going to make the difference. And so it's been great that we've been either able to buy, you know, really expensive used equipment, or now the camera prices have gotten to a point where, you know, they really work, you know, in our favor. There's definitely still some cameras out there that, are expensive and are worth it. You know, we've shot a couple times with Aries that, you know, they're just amazing.
ARRI, those are used in motion picture production, right?
Yeah, the Alexas and the Alexa Minis, and you know, we've shot some pieces with those, and they, you know, an Aerie with an Angenu lens is, you know, it's a, you know, it's $150,000 of hardware, but it looks great, you know, and but on a day-to-day production process, you know, if you're shooting films, you know, the cost of your camera rental is not a huge portion of most film production. So it's not a big deal to spend, you know, to rent that at, you know, let's say $1,500 a day or $2,500 a day over 3-day weeks across, you know, a month and a half. That's not going to be a huge percentage of the cost because you've got, you know, 60 people on site, you're paying, you know, $50,000 a day for labor, you know? And so those are all things that are, you know, that makes sense for film. What we do is day-to-day live production. And so, you know, we need to be more efficient about it. And so,
what's the workflow like with these 5K and, you know, with these high res?
Well, I mean,
for a while, 4K was barely doable.
I mean, the big thing is you just go through a lot of drive space quickly. You just have to keep in mind that you're burning through a lot of data. We're still, you know, while we're slowly moving to 4K, I would say that the majority of our shows are internally 1080p and still streaming occasionally at 720p.
That's what we do. We stream at 720. Yeah.
Right. And a lot of people are.
People don't want more than that, really, for what we do.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that there are times when 4K makes a lot of sense. You know, there's definitely stuff that we've done that looks, you know, amazing at 4K.
Travel logs, nature. Yeah. But yeah. Guys sitting around a table talking.
Yeah, I don't think you need that. Yeah, yeah. So, you don't really need that. And I think that I, and so we've been, you know, moving more to where at least we're doing almost everything in 1080p. And then we do internally are oftentimes starting to work more and more in 4K. And so we wanted to kind of move that, you know, that direction. The great thing again about, and I don't want to turn this into a, you know, Blackmagic, commercial, but it makes it easier because they have a lot of stuff at 4K that isn't super expensive. And so having lots of recorders that do 4K and having lots of the infrastructure and everything else hasn't been a big challenge for us. So anyway, that's why we're kind of,
which lens mount do you use? They support Canon's EF. Yeah, I know you can use Micro Four Thirds in some of the Black Magics.
Yeah, so the smaller ones, so the studios and the micro studios are all four thirds. And those
when you spend great lenses on your Olympus system, you're also getting great video lenses. That's
awesome. For the most part, yeah. There's a couple of little funky things about getting the lens, you know, on occasionally. The Blackmagic one's a little tighter than a typical camera, and so. Especially for adapters, you know, if you're doing EF adapters, there's only very specific ones that work. So those are four thirds. And for us, that's difficult because, you know, most of our pro lenses, the Fujinon and Canon lenses are, they don't do four thirds and it's really hard to adapt to them.
The crop factor on those? Is it similar to Micro Four Thirds cameras? Is it 2X?
Oh, the crop factor is going to be the same.
They're not full frame sensors then.
Right.
They don't need to be, even for 4K or 5K.
In some ways, the four thirds is nicer in that sense because, for instance, a lot of people want to use like B4 mounts on them, which would those are kind of 2/3-inch chips. And so the chips are half size. So making that chip even bigger makes it harder, you know, because you already can't zoom all the way out and you'll get vignetting because the chip's bigger than the lens was designed. And so, so then you have, you have the, you know, the new, after I bought 8 of the mini, the Ursa Minis PL only, and the reason we got PL specifically was because it's easier to rent the lenses. Rental houses have more PLs than they have EFs. And so then the new Mini Pro, of course, now does both B4, PL, and EF, and you can just swap between them.
So EF is Canon. What's PL?
PL is, I don't know what it stands for, but it's just a much more, you know, it's a film.
It's a more standard, like an Arri would use a PL.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Most of your film cameras are using PL. Your B4s are mostly your 2/3 for broadcast. You know, so most of your broadcast cameras are all B4. And then the EF lets you use any of the lenses, which is great because when we're on a cheaper event, we want to be able to throw on, you know, just a little like Canon 7200, you know, is a great thing to use on events that we aren't really big and I don't need to control the lenses. You know, a lot of our stuff is you start changing your view of lenses when you start buying film lenses. You know, these are like, you know, they cost a lot per unit. Yeah. And so
are they better?
Yeah, they're a lot better.
They're noticeably better. Interesting.
I mean, there's certain things you're paying for. I mean, number one, is you can just see the difference in the glass. I mean, you think that these are all the same, like HD is just HD or the glass is just the glass, and it's really not. You know, and you can see that it looks much better. At least I can see that it looks better. And then in addition to that, we have a lot of controls. So the kind of lenses that we're buying for those have these electronic zoom, focus, and aperture controls so that we can tie those into either hand controllers down by the, where operator is holding the camera so that you're not like reaching over and grabbing onto the lens. And then the second thing is that they'll tie into our telemetrics heads. You know, these are big PTZ heads that hold the camera and the lens. And so.
What are you shooting these days? It sounds like you're making movies.
We're close. We're working on it. Most of our stuff is just, most of our work is fairly high end location production, so just live streams that people want to have the best
when you're working quality. with big shots, you want to have a big quality.
Well, and again, those aren't the big expenses for most of our shows. You know, those are fixed costs that we paid for once, and so we're able to add a lot of value without it. You know, the costs of the cost of doing the kind of productions that we have is getting, you know, seven people to France with hardware and putting them up and their hotel costs and everything else. And so those are kind of costs that really impact the production. It's not the, you know, us being able to own the lenses means that they all work together. They're not scratched, that, you know, someone didn't bend all the pins. You know, like those are all the things that I know, all the things that we've had recently.
Good Sam, so, who I figure probably works in the industry, says PL stands for positive lock.
There you go. Positive lock.
Positive lock. So, and I didn't to digress into this week in, you know, video production. However, when you get somebody like Alex around, it's fun to talk about it. And I think we have a lot of people in the biz.
And we didn't need your screen.
Yes. Well, it just so it's rebooted like 100 times.
Oh, Renee, you're so insightful.
Yes. He knew what was going on. And it says now 26 minutes remaining. So I have I have more of a heart.
Okay, who's excited about the next season of Game of Thrones?
Sarah Lane used to say she bought some really nice B&W speakers. She said every time she'd hear that music on there, she'd just get, you know, boom.
Yes. It's amazingly good. Theme music.
It is really good. I'm not sure. I'm not sure the show has maintained its standards, but the music stays really good.
We can
good.
Talk after, about Spider-Man Homecoming, too. I mean, I'm sure we can.
I am not going to talk about Spider-Man Homecoming. I have so little interest in Spider-Man Homecoming.
Michael Keaton, Leo. Just see it for the Michael Keaton.
I heard he was good in this. Who does he play?
He's fantastic.
Is he Doc Ock?
The Vulture.
All right.
We almost got to work on a film when he was just getting started again. Like he had kind of been disappeared, and so it was a little independent film, and we didn't end up working on it, but we almost ended up working on it. And I was so frustrated because now he's so huge.
Yeah, he did Birdman, right? Didn't that kind of change everything?
That. It was before that. There was some independent stuff, but it was Birdman
he's
really kind of launched him. He's such
a
great.
He was
actor.
So good in Beetlejuice, and he's just I would say underrated, except he, as you point out, no longer underrated.
Yeah,
he's also a really great Batman.
He was. I thought he was a good Batman. Yeah,
I thought he was. I thought he was a very good Batman.
Yeah,
and just to show you that even on the pre-internet days, when we had to like write angry fans had to write angry letters, people were upset about the casting of the Beetlejuice. No, it wasn't, was that pre-Beetlejuice? But whatever. But yeah, about the comedian actor as Bruce Wayne. But good heavens, he was good.
I think it was after Batman.
Well,
he's
just so little comedian. Yeah. He does so little comedy. I mean, it's mostly intense.
Well, Night Shift.
Intense personality.
Back then, he was known for Night Shift. He was known. Right. He did a couple of sitcoms. Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that now we're digressing to movie, you know, Roger Ebert. But the
this will be done in 23 minutes, folks. At least that's what my max.
Oh wait, can I pause you? Can I pause you for 1 second? Yeah. This is like an additional like interim pick of the week. Roger Ebert's second volume of the great movies that he decided to do later in his career, just and not necessarily reviews, but essays about the greatest movies of all time by his estimation. Volume two of it is $2 on Amazon on Kindle.
Oh, get it. Get it.
You should get it.
Think about this. You're going to buy the book, but then you're going to spend hundreds of dollars on DVDs, Blu-ray DVDs.
With no regrets.
Regrets.
Back up to 12? Okay, well, it's still a good deal.
Get the paperback. It's cheaper in paperback.
Darn it. I guess it expired.
Must have been a Prime deal. Has anybody been doing the Amazon Prime thing?
I have. I bought a UPS that I actually already had my eye on. That was the Newegg had it for like 190, and it was down to 110.
Wirecutter did an analysis last year where it looked like fewer than 10% of the deals on the Prime deals were actually deals.
So does anyone else have this experience though? Like in Canada, Amazon Prime is really new. Like it had a couple features, but now it's getting more. And I signed up for it, and now it looks like Uber drivers are delivering my stuff. Guys show up with really strange accents that I'm not sure are Terran, and they in cars, and they just and it's like Sunday at 3 p.m. bring your package, just yar. And I think one was a Klingon.
Are these Klingons delivering?
I don't know, but I don't. And there's nothing official to say it was Amazon. It was just a guy with an envelope.
Yeah, the dots were down to what they were. Pretty cheap. They were like 25, 30 bucks.
The Echo, the Echo is down. Is half price. Yeah. That's like, look at that. That's an oh my god kind of price.
This is this year. The 3 p.m. tally on the Wirecutter, because they're doing a great job of this. Of 17,200 deals, only 98.
Right. That's no joke.
We're good
every time that there's like some sort of like a gold box deal, if I want it, I will put it in my basket and then spend that 14 and a half minutes looking online saying, okay, so I could buy this art kit anywhere else, including on Amazon for about the same price anytime I want. So, yeah,
good,
be careful.
Good tip.
I'm sorry, Alex, but I interrupt you, Alex. We were saying, okay, we're now
all I was going to say is the
Siskel,
other
Siskel and Ebert about.
Well, and also my favorite book by Roger Ebert is the Pot and how to use it.
Which I right have, about I have
followed along. He was a prolific rice cooker chef.
He wrote a book about rice cookers.
He was an absolute. He was like Julia Child with a and I'm not talking about I'm talking about like your basic Japanese. I think the one that he liked had some smarts in it, but wasn't like an $8,000 thing. It was basically go anywhere, buy it for $70.
Would it and be he more than rice?
Anything in it. Stews, whole chickens, everything.
It took me a little while to get over the fact that I shouldn't put anything in it. I've been a purist of like I only put
you
rice.
Put rice in your rice cooker because it'll flavor it otherwise. Maybe not.
But no, it doesn't. It doesn't.
So everybody loves these quick pots now. That's the thing, right? Or what do they call it? Yeah.
Like the combination pressure cooker. Yeah. No,
it's a pressure cooker plus slow cooker in one device.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the rice cookers now have that. I chose when I got my last rice cooker not to. I was cheap. And now I look back on it, I go, oh, it would have been nice. But it's like another $100, $150 to get one. I didn't get it. But because I was just like, I just like making my rice.
And maybe there'll be a Prime Day deal on rice cooker / quick pots.
Actually, wire cutter, I did retweet.
It's deeply discounted for Prime Day.
Not only that, but my favorite sous vide cooker is down to $100, which is you see on Black Friday, but that's about it. Wirecutter did tweet that. I did retweet Wirecutter's tweet out about this deal, so it is a good deal. That is my own sous vide.
I'm pissed off because I cannot buy a sous vide cooker because I ordered that one.
Yeah, I know.
Year and a half or 2 years ago, Andy told me about it. And I said, this sounds great because it kept it cool. And then it would, the iPhone controlled it and would cook later. And where is it? It's not, just add it to the list of crap I bought on Indiegogo and Kickstarter that I'll never see.
Yeah, I know. That's always a bummer when you buy hardware on Indiegogo that hasn't actually been made yet. They were very nice.
They wrote to me and they said, oh, we're so glad you got one. And
yeah,
the better news is I get ones that I, you know, if I do anything like that, it comes like 8 months later. I forgot that it even existed. Right. And so it's just like,
it's funny because like, my pick of the week I ordered a year ago came yesterday. So I have one exactly like that. And, you know, I don't mind that they're taking a while as long as it comes out. My problem is I can't buy anything else because I spent a lot of money on a sous vide cooker.
Okay. Think about it this way. So this one, it's normally like $150, $175. You can get it for $100. That means that this is the Anova Bluetooth model.
I only see it as $149.
Right, but today it's when you check it out, when you check out, you
it's a
get
prime deal. That's not the Wi-Fi one. That's the non-Wi-Fi.
You don't need the Wi-Fi one.
I always control it from the appliance. But here's the deal. Like when it comes time to like cook your Thanksgiving dinner, it means that you're gonna have one bath that's at like cooking temperature, and another bath that when something is cooked, it's now at basically keep this thing warm for the table temperature.
So you need more than one sous vide cooker.
Oh, I have.
And not only that, but there are times where you're gonna want to do the 24-hour bacon or the 24-hour brisket, and so that's gonna tie up your sous vide for an entire day.
Alex is about to tell us how many he has.
Load balancing.
I can tell you how many I have. I have too many. But the main thing is
load balance sous vide cookers.
I have to admit that I'm testing them. Yep. I've been testing them.
He rack mounts them, Leo. He rack mounts them. They're 3 years. Yeah.
No. It's just that I was.
How many can you fit in an anvil case?
No, so I'm testing different ones, and so I have cheap ones. They're
that's
not
what
all
you tell
Nova,
Carlita, your wife. I'm testing them.
Exactly.
That's what I tell my wife. I'm testing it, honey.
Right. And
Syracuse.
I had ribs that had to sit for 24 hours, but I also had someone coming over, and we needed to cook a tri-tip. And so these are all things that you have to deal with, you know, there's different temperatures, different times, different sizes. But I will agree with Andy, the Anova is the
best. That's the one. Okay.
I have a lot of different ones, and it is the best. I mean, it's just – the other ones, it's not that they don't work. You know, that's the funny thing is they don't work. It's that they do weird things. Like I get into it, and I can't change the temperature unless I turn it off, and it's just – you know, it's – and it – you know, but as far as – and at $99, oh, my gosh. It's
Yeah, the difference between is that the Innova is built like a kitchen appliance that they added some electronics to. And like companies will send me like their new sous vide cookers, and I have to like write them back after months. I'm not going to review this because you basically built this consumer electronics gadget that you could cook stuff with. It doesn't behave like a kitchen appliance. Unless it would look at home on one of the counters at the British Baking Show, I think that you need to go back and reconsider what you're doing.
I have a counter issue, frankly. I have way too many things in the counters, and many of them mysteriously disappear only to be found later in the garage. So I just really don't dare add anything more to my counter.
Well, the Innova is something I will say. The sous vide is something that I use almost every day.
Yeah.
Not quite. And I think the big breakthrough also was what was really slowing me down is I was vacuum packing everything. And then Andy was like, no, I just put it in a Ziploc bag. And I'm like, oh, the Ziploc bag. And now there's chefs online that say you should never do that. It's dangerous. But
Well, because not all of them are heat safe. I've actually switched to vacuum sealing things because that means I can basically cook in a hand. I can basically fill a bag in advance, put it in the freezer. But here was one of the big breakthrough moments for myself where they tell you that, oh, try a steak, try a burger, try chicken. And it is the best you've ever done. But then I thought, wait a minute. Then I thought I'm about to eat one of my I don't want to be bothered with cooking, but I need to eat something for dinner because I also missed lunch, which is basically taking a frozen microwave burrito out of from the grocery store, and I'm about to put it in the microwave. It's like, wait a minute, what if I were to put this in a bag, put this in the sous vide, and I swear to God, it was the best. It almost becomes restaurant quality because it heats I'm telling you, because the tortilla is completely soft and moist and heated through.
I totally no dried out spots. How long did it take, Andy?
You add whatever the cooking time was about an hour. I added about 20 minutes because it was still frozen. But but here's the deal with sous vide. It's not just the time with the microwave oven. You spend 4 minutes like standing there looking at the microwave waiting for this thing to finish spinning. With the sous vide, somewhere around 2 hours plus or minus an hour before you feel like you're going to eat, you put it in the machine, you walk away from it, and now you've got this 2 hour window in which you can take it out at any time, and it will be perfect temperature, it'll be safe to eat, it'll be as tasty as this thing can possibly be. So that's because sometimes it's like I know that I'm going to want to eat around 6, but now it's 6 o'clock and I'm still waiting for something to compile, or I'm still waiting for something to render, or I've got my head like lodged in some sort of a problem. And I don't wind up eating until 7, but that's okay. I can just simply walk over, take the thing out of the bath, cut the bag open, put it in a plate, pour some salsa on top of it. Boom.
Waterboy wants to know what temperature for a frozen burrito.
My rule of thumb is that if it's a frozen commercial product, and I don't know whether it's cooked inside or not, it's pre-cooked or not, 165 degrees, that will make it that is the mouth temperature of piping hot. And plus, it will make sure that anything that is not cooked has definitely been cooked.
Right.
If I were making meats myself, it would be about 129. I did burgers for the 4th of July, pre-cooked them in the sous vide, then grill them. Those were about 129. That also points out the only other hazard of sous vide cooking is that if you post pictures of this wonderful, like inch thick, deeply charred burger that you have, people say, oh my God, look, it's all pink and raw inside. You're going to get so sick. It's like, no, it's sous vide. It's all been cooked to a beautiful, like medium rare. It's perfectly okay. The first time you slice into a chicken breast and say, oh, that's a little pink. I've been told that pink chicken will kill me. There was a book in junior high in home ec I had to read that said, look, here's what undone chicken taste looks like. Don't eat it. And then you eat it.
So it stays pink though it's up to 145 or whatever the safe time.
Because it has to be over 132 for an hour or something like that. Okay. It'll kill everything.
Oh, length of time is key as well. Right.
Right. Yep. But the way that I explain is that imagine that you're a Bond villain and that the things that will make you sick are James Bond. You can either kill it. You can either kill James Bond by shoving him into an active volcano.
Yeah.
And he will. And doesn't matter how long he spends in that volcano, he is dead. That is the equivalent of putting a chicken in a conventional oven and pulling it out at 165 degrees. At any length of time, if it's 165 degrees inside there, it's the things that are going to harm you are dead. Sous vide is more like I'm waiting for him to finish his squash tournament, and now he's in the sauna at the gym, and now I'm going to weld the door shut and turn the heat all the way up to high.
Right.
It's going to take him about an hour and a half, 2 hours to die, but he's still going to be dead.
He'll still be thoroughly cooked.
Right.
All right.
And which sealer do you use?
When did I lose control of this show?
When you clicked OK, sure, let's upgrade macOS.
I know, anyway, I'm almost done.
I use whatever model of Food Saver was discounted from $80 down to $53 on some Black Friday. I actually wanted to save money and say, gee, I don't want to have to spend 23 cents every time I cook something to seal something in a bag. But then the sealer, I got a deal in the sealer. And then I realized that although I still use it's more convenient because now, again, I can spend like one day on Sunday pretty much filling bags with things that I want to eat over the course of the week.
I just realized
including meats, vegetables, sauces. And then it's like I'm creating my own frozen supermarket dinners, only I'm
this
making
is
it
the
myself.
Stackhouse filibuster for MacBreak Weekly. We've got all the grandfathers. They were there before you. They'll be there after you. And you're lining up to take their turn at the mic.
Somebody said, you don't kill the bacteria by heat. It just dies of boredom. So
I'd like to read Fantastic Four 552 entered into the congressional record. Panel 1, Chapter 2, the middle of the end.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, my machine will reboot and we can talk about there's still not that much to talk about, but I'm sure. Oh, you know what? We got to talk about Qualcomm. And yes, you're going to explain to me why Apple's right and Qualcomm's wrong, because I'm starting to think Qualcomm has some merit in their case here. It is heating up, but we'll talk about it in just a second. First, though, let's talk about ZipRecruiter. If you're the person who does the hiring in your company, you have the most important job in your company. I know your pay does not probably reflect that, but it's true. All a company is, as Steve Jobs very famously said this, a company is the 20th century's or the whatever 19th century's most significant invention. The idea that you could get a bunch of people together, align on a goal, and use all that brain power and skill together to make something no individual could make is immensely powerful. But it's made of people. And the right people can make it all work beautifully, can make it hum. The wrong people can bring it right down to the ground. And that's why it's important to do your job and do it right. Now, let's assume you got an opening, you know, and your company, whether you're the HR person or maybe it's like me, you're the chief cook and bottle washer. Let's assume that right person's out there. How do you find them? What job boards are they on? Where do they live? Well, with ZipRecruiter, it doesn't matter, because with ZipRecruiter, you're going to post to 100 plus job boards, all the social networks, with one click of the mouse. So you're going to reach the most people. You're going to reach the right person. And now you're going to say, well, I got a massive haystack. How do I find that needle in the haystack? Well, the good news is those applications don't come to your email inbox. They don't come to your phone. They're not calling you. They all flow into the ZipRecruiter interface. Now, you can pre-configure that interface with appropriate questions to help you screen the person. True, false, multiple choice, even essay questions. You can rank them, rate them, and hire the right person fast. See that thumbs up, thumbs down? It's just that easy. So that means that you're going to have what you want, the most possible applicants, and the easiest job of sifting through them so you can find the thing you need the most, the right person for your job. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. No wonder more than a million companies have used ZipRecruiter. You know, 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. You're going to love ZipRecruiter, and I want you to try it free, because I know once you use it, you're going to get hooked. We love it. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit, ZipRecruiter.com/twit, and you could post jobs for free right now. ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of every size, small, medium, and huge, to find the best candidates. Immediate results at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. Try it for free. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. 12 minutes remaining. What was I thinking? It's, by the way, just if you're doing this, just a word of warning, if you sit and watch it, which you shouldn't, you should go pretend it's sous-viding your Mac OS and go wander off. But it did some scary things. It rebooted many, many times. The screen, I guess it was updating a video driver, was doing weird stuff for a while. So be prepared for that if you're going to High Sierra. Best just not watch it, right, Renee? Just let it do its thing unwatched. Yep. Yeah. Qualcomm. All right. So the latest is Qualcomm has gone to the U.S. International Trade Organization, which despite its name really is the organization that determines what can be imported into the United States, and asked that no Intel radio-based iPhones, be imported into the United States. They're trying to have an embargo on that. Qualcomm, of course, makes the radios that have been in iPhones until the iPhone 7. For the first time, Apple went to a second source, so they have some iPhone 7s with Qualcomm. Those are the ones, I think, for the CDMA carriers.
Well, sort of. Apple was originally using Infineon modems, which Intel bought. So Intel now makes the Infineon-based modems.
Oh,
and
I didn't know that.
To Qualcomm. Yeah, they switched to Qualcomm for CDMA because Qualcomm has like a jaw lock on CDMA
technology.
Well,
they invented it. Yeah. So Qualcomm's position is we have at least six patents that are not FRAND patents. We can debate the FRAND patents too, yes. But at least six patents that Apple uses and does not want to pay us for. And that seems like a compelling argument to me. Apple for sure demands people who use their patents either license them or not use them. Why should Apple not have to license them from Qualcomm? I know, Renee, you probably have a good argument, so let me hear it.
I don't know if it's a good argument or not, because this is an issue we've talked
it's
about
complicated.
In the past. It's complicated, and it's also maddening, and it is something that is horribly broken. But the gist of it is Qualcomm basically controls CDMA technology, and that wouldn't matter except that Verizon and Sprint in the U.S. are still deployed massive CDMA networks.
It's all being replaced by LTE day now.
Yeah, we're just not there yet. But in other countries, it has been replaced, or they were using GSM to begin with. So it is only a problem that really affects people who want to use their phones on Verizon and Sprint. But if you want to offer a world phone, which is very appealing to a lot of people, especially to a major market in the U.S., and there is some CDMA in China, so especially to major markets, you need to use those Qualcomm patents. Now, Apple was using Qualcomm modems, but Qualcomm doesn't Qualcomm wants to charge you what is in essence a whole device licensing fee. That's my understanding, at least. The terms are super secret.
Instead of having a flat fee to license the patent, they want a cut of every phone.
Or a cut of just that part. Like, for example, if they're responsible for 10% of the phone, they would get profits based on that 10% of the phone. They want profits based on 100% of that phone. And some people have said it's based not on wholesale price, but on retail price.
Right.
And a good reflection of that is paying $130 more for a cellular iPad, which Apple just, you know, carries on to the person, because that is roughly, I believe, you know, it's probably inflated a little bit, but it's roughly what Qualcomm gets just for having you have the ability. Sorry, I'll back up, because iPads still use the Qualcomm modem. All iPads use that one Qualcomm modem, just for the ability to operate on Verizon in the U.S.
Yeah, because they have a single SIM multi-carrier solution on that one.
Totally. So everyone in the world is basically paying Qualcomm for the right to operate on Verizon and Sprint. And people outside the U.S. obviously aren't super happy about that, but it's the world that we live in. Now, some of these patents are covered by FRAND, which is fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory. And that means that you are allowed to be the standard that everyone has to use, because we want – it's like having different sized train tracks. No train could ever get anywhere. If we agree to use your standard, you have to then license those things fairly, reasonably, and with no discrimination to everyone who wants to use that standard. These patents aren't under FRAND. It's arguable that they should be, because they are essential to using that technology that everyone has agreed is the technology that we want to use. But essentially what Apple is arguing is that Qualcomm is not doing fair licensing, that they're trying to hold Apple and –
But this is an important distinction. They're not technically supposed to be FRAND.
No, but even the non-FRAND ones, I believe Apple and some other countries, like the U.S. is not alone in looking at Qualcomm. China, I believe Korea are also looking at them, because you're not allowed to abuse these patents either. Even if they're not FRAND.
Even if they're not FRAND,
my understanding is you can't abuse your strength in one position to force people. And it's been alleged that they force people to do many other things in order to get this essentially irreplaceable technology. And Apple decided they no longer wanted to, whether we would ever see the cost savings of that, Apple decided they no longer wanted to,
and we should
from their point of you be held ransom.
In all likelihood, we're paying for this, because they just pass along the costs to us. It raises the cost of the phone, so Apple doesn't want to do that because they're already expensive. They don't want to add the cost.
It's an edge case. you know, that's
a good
part for Apple is that it's an edge case for the something that people, you know, use occasionally. And so they're paying
but
a huge
I would argue, sure, it's an edge case, but you know what? That's the deal. Nobody's disputing that Qualcomm invented these technologies. They're not, you know, doing a patent troll thing or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's against the two things. It's like if Qualcomm is saying if you want to use our modems, you have to use our XYZ as well, then that becomes a bigger problem. And also if Qualcomm is charging exorbitant rates, there is some – I'm not a lawyer, so please do not hold me to any of this stuff. But there are ways of abusing it beyond just a simple FRAND abuse.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why FRAND exists. Basically gives companies like Apple the ability to say as soon as a company like Qualcomm theoretically goes a bit too far, that puts a gun in Apple's hand to say, "Okay, look, we'll put up with this and then we put up with that, but now this is way too much. If your terms are unfair, if you're clearly not doing if you're clearly doing this in a restrictionary way, if you're truly abusing the fact that you are the only game in town, at this point, I have to tell you that no, we're not going to do that." So that's why that principle exists. I'm not sure that that Qualcomm is innocent of violating the idea of FRAND.
And for Qualcomm, they're trying to cash in as long as they can. You know, both
because it's almost over for them, right?
Yeah, limits of the patent as well as limits of the usage of it. Right. You know, at some point, Apple could decide that, well, we've decided that we're just not going to use it anymore because enough of the world has moved some other direction. That's unlikely in the short term, but could be possible in the longer term. And I think that's where Apple would prefer to go. And so, you know, they're trying to make sure they get the most out of it before it's no longer useful.
Yeah.
Yeah. They want to pay, I believe they want to pay Qualcomm based on Qualcomm's contribution to the overall device and not based on a very high rate on the entire cost of the device.
So,
yeah, it doesn't scale. Like if the let's say the camera person did the same thing. We have an exclusive patent on taking photographs. You've got to pay us. Not everybody can take 12% of the retail price of the phone. There would be 180% of the cost of the phone very quickly.
Yeah, but
also just to clarify, this isn't a patent troll sort of situation where they patent something very, very broad. Qualcomm, one of the reasons why the phone business did take off the way it did was Qualcomm putting a lot of money into some basic technology that may or may not have paid off in the future back when phones were still a very dodgy proposition. And like Alex says, there's a reason why the patents are supposed to expire so that you can absolutely make hay while the sun is shining, because at some point you're going to be holding the rights to something that everybody can absolutely have access to and not pay you a cent for. So I don't think that this is an evil thing that Qualcomm is doing. I'm not even necessarily sure that they're wrong, but I do think that this is a complex issue.
And they benefited because the CDMA modems, they were not as what's the right word? They were not as good as GSM, but they had per tower you could service a larger area. So it let and getting Wayfair and getting the ability to put your towers in many places was very hard, especially in the beginning. AT&T, I believe, had the army. Sprint had railways, and they could put those up because Sprint was a railway company. And Verizon was able to, using CDMA technology, put up these EVDO and I forget what the name of the base technology was, and service a much larger area than they would have been able to otherwise. So it benefited them the same way it benefited Bell and Telus. They just did not convert to GSM and HSPA as fast as some of the other countries did. So we're sort of stuck with the legacy of that.
Well, and it's also, and we see things like this. I mean, the HEVC holdouts and why HEVC took so long to come out is specifically because of the licensing issues.
This is a video compression technology. It's MPEG-5.
It's a huge jump from H.264. And it's been around for quite some time now. A lot of us are waiting. We all have encoders that will do HEVC, and no one's actually using it because no. And also, you have big, you know, large companies that are doing CDNs that want to use VP9 specifically because they don't want to pay for HEVC. You know, and so these licensing things really hold up a lot of. I'm not saying that they shouldn't. There's a lot of people putting money into it, but that's what you know. A lot of these platforms and so on and so forth. A lot of our costs that we pay as consumers are based on these. It's like a VAT. Right. it's like an industrial VAT.
I stand. I'll just say I don't have the technology, the brains, or the information to judge in this fight. But I'm not convinced Apple's right any more than Qualcomm's right.
I think they should execute it in the court and not try to be barring imports of the phone. I think there's enough.
Remember, Apple's withholding like $1 billion in payments. it's hurting Qualcomm economically. I mean, Apple could, whether there's merit in their case or not, by withholding those payments could severely injure Qualcomm.
It's both weapons in their arsenal. Like the Apple doing that hopes to accelerate a deal. Right. Like most of these companies, they have billions of dollars to litigate for as long as they want. The lawyers get newer and better Ferraris. And eventually, like they just settled with Nokia. And those are lawsuits that have been going back and forth for a while. Either they will get to court and we'll have something like the Samsung verdict happen, or they'll one day, like tomorrow, there'll be a press release saying we've settled it and we've come to this and that terms. But right now, it's a lot of legal posturing.
So you remember the Apple ad with the snail and the Intel chip, the Pentium 2 chip.
Oh.
Apple was talking about how slow Intel
Some
chips were.
Some people think the Pentium 2 is the fastest processor in the world. Not quite. The chip inside every new Power Macintosh G3 is up to twice as fast.
Think different. Except, of course, Intel was furious and said, that's not true. But Steve Jobs, there was no love shared with Intel and Steve Jobs. Yeah, and Apple. There's quite a few ads in both directions. But the reason I'm bringing this up, there's a great article. Ken Segal's Observatory of Watchful Eye and Technology and Marketing, called Steve Jobs and the Missing Intel Inside Sticker. I missed this when it first came out, but I think Karsten found it. Why is there... So Apple, you know, hell froze over, as we well remember. And I was very upset about it at the time when Apple decided to dump the PowerPC chips and go with Intel. We were doing this show when that happened, I think. Maybe not. I thought it was a terrible idea. What year did they decide to first... 2006. So yeah,
it was Tiger, right? OS 10 Tiger.
We were doing this show.
Codename Marklar for those South Park fans.
Marklar. Is that a South Park reference?
I think it's a South Park alien, isn't it? The aliens from South Park.
Oh my God, I didn't know that. See, this is what you get for not watching enough
Delightful.
TV. And Steve decided to go with Intel. And Ken Segal says, I approached him with my biggest concern. Please, Steve, tell me we won't have to put the Intel... Inside logo on our Macs. Jobs looked him in the eye and said, trust me, I made sure that's in the contract. So to this day, when you buy a Windows machine, it almost invariably has an Intel Inside sticker, which you have to peel off and then get the goo off. It's very annoying.
Most people just leave it.
Yeah, people do, and it surprises me. Yeah. And there's a Windows 10 logo on it too. It surprises me because I just find that it sticks up. It's annoying. Well, Steve did not want that on his beautiful Macintoshes, but they did have a photograph of a processor with the Intel corporate logo on the box. One of the designs shared with Steve placed the Intel chip apart from the other features under the large iMac image. Steve hated it. He felt Intel was an important part of the computer, but no more important than their other features. He preferred simply adding Intel to the feature list on the side of the box. It's just one more reason to buy a Mac, but not the reason. He was not willing to siphon off any brand value to Intel. And a great inside story by Ken Segal. Thank you.
Is there another story about how he wanted them to get rid of the Apple logos in the interface because there was too many and it was devaluing the brand and they wanted to see like one or two strategically positioned.
That makes sense.
Very brand conscious.
Yeah, you can say it too. You can say something too often and then people become immune to it. Although putting it on the back of the computer like this is probably the best ad of all, right?
Yeah, especially when they were glowing on other people's press conferences.
Yeah, at the Microsoft press conferences, all the glowing apples in the front row was never a good thing. Not for Microsoft.
Steve loved it.
I love that story. Segal was a marketing guy at Next Apple. Tomorrow, we should mention, is a day of action for net neutrality. Because, of course, as you know, the FCC is right now trying to let me stop this autoplay video. I want to do a day of action against autoplay video. Can we do that?
Safari does it for you in High Sierra. That would not have happened if you were running High Sierra.
I am running High Sierra.
Safari.
Oh, I'm running Chrome. Damn it. I gotta switch over to Safari now. By the way, yes, I am running High Sierra.
Bum, 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 bum.
But not dum, dum, dum. So the day of action is to get everybody to write to the FCC and say, please, the current comment period lasts until July 17th, and then there's a second round. There's the website. Please, everybody, participate. Write your member of Congress. I'm a kind of a fan of net neutrality because without it, I'd seriously doubt Twit would exist.
Love that checkbox for having. I have a large technology following. Or
yeah, large audience. I checked that. Yeah. Savetheinternet.com. You can take action. You can find out more about it. And I should let you know, you can sign the petition, whatever it is. You know, you make a call to your Congress critter, tweet it. That's the least, that's the slacktivist choice. But so tomorrow's the big day. And I just want a word of warning. We are going to participate in it. We're not going to go dark, though. We're going to do the same thing we did during the SOPA protests some years ago. We're going to be in black and white. So if you tune
that's
in.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of appropriate. What a lot of sites will do, some big sites too, is slow you down, show a spinning, thing to and saying this is what the internet will be like. Net neutrality is important because, you know, we can compete with the big boys. We can stream video to you at the same speed as Netflix and YouTube and everybody else. Because the internet doesn't discriminate against bits currently. But you know Comcast and AT&T and Verizon would just love to make a little extra bucks by charging people to have high-speed access to you, thereby disenfranchising people like us who couldn't afford to pay. Net neutrality is about to go away, and we've got to at least let them know it's a big deal. So...
I think it blunted. I mean, the online attack blunted the last push against this.
Oh, by far. I mean,
lost their stomach.
No question at all.
There are only two things that scare a congressperson. One is the Koch brothers underrunning the campaign of somebody else, and the other is actual phone calls and letters to the office. So yeah, don't just this will be useful, but either your congresspeople have phone numbers, call their offices.
That's the most effective thing you can do.
Because that wasn't you wasting 5 seconds in between Reddit and Facebook. This is you actually having to find out how your phone works once again to make an analog voice call and calling in. It really does have a bigger impact.
Yeah. And if you need to know more, EFF has a lot of stuff, EFF.org, savetheinternet.com. Participate, be an activist in this case. I think it's quite important.
Is there anything international people can do? Can we just pretend to be Americans for the day?
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing is...
bandwagon.
You're going to be affected by what we do here, right?
Totally.
I guess you can't really call a member of Congress.
We'll stop spending money on American companies unless you give us an open internet.
I think, you know, we wouldn't have a Title II regulation of net neutrality if it weren't for all the 1.5 million plus comments that the previous chairman of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, got last year because of people like Colbert and many sites protesting. SOPA would be the law of the land if it weren't for the protests a couple of years ago. So I think, yeah, you're absolutely right, Andy. If you want to dilute or even... next week, the day against autoplay video. I'm telling you, we got
it. We're all going to use Safari.
But if you want to blunt the effect of money in politics, money only buys votes. That's the value of the money. Yes. So you can buy ad campaigns. You can influence voters. If the voters speak up, that carries more weight than anything. So speak up. Mm. Speak up.
Yeah, it's too bad because... I don't know. It's we now have an FCC chairman that is very aware of and cognizant of the problems with internet access right now. Enough of them to at least invoke them when speaking of the reasons to eliminate or his reasons to eliminate net neutrality. I hope that this change in net neutrality dies. But I hope he's still I hope that he's actually sincere about making sure that rural broadband and broadband to lower income communities remains a focus of his, because that is another emerging tech crisis in our country that we need to address.
Yeah, there was a story this morning that Microsoft, I kind of misread the story, and you might have too, unveils $10 billion rural air push for rural broadband internet. But Microsoft's not chipping in $10 billion. They're just pushing for other people to do the same thing.
I wasn't aware of that story, but crisis is too strong a word, but we can't ignore the fact that while we talk about, hey, look, this company's creating a kajillion dollar spaceship campus, and look, this other company is doing this, that, and the other, we can't ignore the fact that there are school systems that still just don't have access to the internet.
23.4 million Americans lack high-speed internet access because they live in rural areas.
And that means access, cutting off access to education, cutting off access to jobs, because go to a public, hang out in a public library for a couple of hours and hang out near the public internet kiosks, terminals, and you will see people using it mostly to look for jobs online and to Skype interviews and stuff like that online. And so it really is, it's not quite at the same level of cutting off a community from electricity and clean water, but it's in the same rough category. And it's not a problem that's going to solve itself. It's not a problem that's going to solve itself by this part of the industry becoming more profitable and companies like Comcast and Verizon wanting to chase up after that wonderful money of companies where there counties where there is high levels of unemployment. This is going to be a thing where whoever it is who is in charge of our national internet service, such as perhaps the FCC, makes that a priority and takes active measures to make sure that every kid who needs access to the internet can find access to the internet, even if it's not necessarily inside their own house, at least inside their own towns.
What Microsoft is proposing, which is kind of interesting, is using television white space, unused television bandwidth, to wire 12 states by next year and connect 2 million people over the next 5 years. They call it the Rural Air Band Initiative. It's a form of wireless internet. So Microsoft's contributing a considerable amount. I just, not $10 billion. Connecting everybody using TV white space technology would cost between $10 and $15 billion. So there's a significant investment required, but it is so important. I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they're trying to get some government money, some private money to do that. So well done. And we wish you best. And the funny thing is AT&T is joining tomorrow's protest. This is from Tech Dirt. AT&T pretends to love net neutrality and joins tomorrow's protest with a straight face.
I shall clothe myself in the robes of my enemy and walk amongst them.
Ooh, I like it. What's that from?
I don't know. It just sounded appropriate.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
I think it was AT&T who kind of started the debate back in 2005 when their CEO at the time, Ed Whitaker, said, "We're not going to let Google ride my pipes for free."
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Mm-hmm. You, Google,
possible
you.
Possible show title? That's a candidate. We should discuss that one.
Ride my pipes for free.
Ride your pipes for free. Let's see. What else do we want to talk about? You can preserve the national parks when you use your Apple Pay. Just yet another reason to use Apple Pay between now and the 15th. So hurry up and go buy something. For every Apple Pay transaction from any Apple Store, Apple.com, or the App Store in the U.S., Apple will donate $1 to the National Park Foundation. I should have told you about this earlier. But
so buy each piece of vegetable separately.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, it has to be in the Apple Store, Apple.com, or the App Store in the
U.S.
Okay,
so you can't,
use it for veggies. Unless Apple starts selling veggies in the Apple Store,
I don't think so. They missed their opportunity to buy Whole Foods.
Yeah. This was a stat that
got everybody panicked.
Apple buys Whole Foods. Wait a minute.
I just wanted to buy a blue bottle, put it in every Genius bar.
Oh, I like that. Why isn't there a coffee
shop? Or Phil's. Just put Phil's in every Genius bar.
The Apple Store should have a coffee shop.
Yeah.
Or just free coffee. Nielsen, this headline got me excited, but maybe not everybody. Nielsen says, on-demand audio streaming hits record high, is up 62.4% over last year. And I think everybody assumes it's Spotify and Apple Music, but no, it's just audio. So it could be podcasts. I don't know how much podcasts contributed to this, but I think it's some, right? Audio of any kind, audio listening of any kind. Ed Sheeran's Shape of You was the top on-demand song during this time frame. 2 million downloads, 4.35 million units streamed.
Yeah, and one of the things that's, you know, as this becomes the norm and as we really, as this becomes the largest part of the industry, I think a lot of the checks that a lot of these folks are going to get much more reasonable. I was talking to an artist that I'll leave unnamed that has a lot of stuff on Spotify, and they said that they actually make a lot of money on Spotify.
See, that's important because we always have this impression they make nothing.
Yeah, they say they don't make anything because they own their tracks on Spotify.
Ah, not, the studio is making company. Something for everybody else. Yeah.
Yeah, I said the problem is going through the studio and getting paid for that. Yeah. It's not the if you're the owner of the actual content, which is more and more doable now than it ever has been. The studios provide less and less impact, you know, on sales. That you know you actually can do fairly well, at least according to the artist that I was talking to.
So Nielsen doesn't break down in this stat. Audio includes spoken word as well as and podcasts as well as music. They don't break it down. But a prior figure from Nielsen said that monthly podcast consumption doubled over the last 5 years among adults. So that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
I think it's us.
I like to think it's all Mac.
You're welcome. Yes. You're welcome, Internet.
Yes.
And you know what? It's with all of these segments we do in which we install a system update and just have to talk over it.
And I spent a lot of time talking about sous vide in the middle of a Mac show.
Our ad sales department is awaiting your phone call or text or Snapchat, everybody.
Nielsen's streaming hit a high point of 7.5 billion weekly on-demand audio streams the week of March 9th this year. First time it had ever topped 7 billion. On-demand audio has been streamed over 184 billion times so far in 2017. That's the 62.4% increase. On-demand audio and video streams, of course we do both, have surpassed 284 billion streams this year. That's a 36% increase. I know a lot of this is Netflix and Spotify and Apple, but I have to think that we're a little bit of it. The podcasts in general are a little bit, not this show particularly, but there's a little bit of
this show particularly.
Why not?
Don't throw a basket over our light. Come on.
Don't know if it'll happen. We mentioned that Apple might exceed $1 trillion value over the next 12 months. Samsung may beat Apple in quarterly profit for the first time.
Is that Samsung Mobile or the entire kit?
See, that's the thing. I don't think it's Samsung. This is a CNBC. Analyst consensus. Let me see if we can break that down. I hate going to CNBC because they always have autoplay video on their site.
Samsung is like 1900.
It's Samsung Electronics. So nice. So they're set to report 11.5 billion profit in Q2. Apple's 10.49 billion. It'd be the first time Samsung's profit would be higher than Apple.
And ironically, some of that is probably manufacturing components.
It's OLED displays that Apple's buying.
And chipsets. I mean, they manufacture a lot of. Yeah.
And we really ought to celebrate in honor of Rene Ritchie the 1 year anniversary of Pokemon Go.
Okay. I wrote a review yesterday. Yep. My first game review since letterpress.
What was the actual release date? I know it was in July.
July 7th, I think.
Okay. We went crazy. That's all we talked about for months.
I mean, there were people flooding the streets. It was hard to ignore.
It was very hard.
I've seen some of the finest minds of my generation, et cetera, et cetera.
And what's sad is that this was a very popular game, but I think they did not improve it fast enough to keep a lot of users using it. It's still very popular, though, right?
Did you see that graph that they revealed about what they built for, what the worst case scenario they thought was, and what the actual load was?
No.
Yeah, they said that they planned for, I think, two or three times what they actually expected and got something like 100 to 200 times.
So they couldn't really roll out new features as fast as they'd like to.
No. There was an interesting interview with John Hankey, who's the CEO of Niantic. And he said like all their plans got thrown back 6 months because they had to take all their resources, devote that to infrastructure, and just completely rewrite everything that they had been working on.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, I'm not surprised. Yeah, it's been this was an article in The Verge, I think, that they interviewed John Hanke. Yeah. Well, they have added new features now, right?
It's amazing, Leo. So, like, there's these things called raids now where, like, previously you would battle over gyms and different teams would battle over them. But now, like, all the teams can come together and fight these raids. And what's interesting is you get one free raid a day and you've got to pay a dollar for every other one. And even in my small little suburban community, there's 20 to 30 people in the rain fighting these raids and going from one to the other. And if I multiply that math out over, like, my city and then my province, then my country, and then all countries, it's like it's a license to print money all over again.
Yeah. Yeah. So your sense is people, at least in Montreal, are still using this game as much as ever.
They still have a pretty engaged. I mean, I think in the U.S. it's even more popular, and in some other countries it's far more popular. And it's a beloved franchise. It uses AR, it uses real location. People have a sense of getting out. Now the new system promotes a lot of what they wanted, which is social cooperative gameplay. So you have a group of 20 or 30 people who'd never seen each other before suddenly working together to solve a problem, and a lot of people seem to really enjoy that. So I think, you know, as long as they could do it again with maybe Harry Potter and magical creatures or something. But I think it was a good combination of the advent of AR with, again, a beloved childhood franchise.
Well, happy birthday, Pokemon Go. And, you know, I don't play it all the time, but I still, you know, I'll fire it up once in a while. Lisa and I both will fire it up once in a while. It's still a lot of fun. It really
you guys got to go on a raid.
So how do you get raiding?
So when you open up the app, there's a tab next to the whatever Pokemon are nearby. There's a tab called Raids, and it'll show you what raids are in your area. And there's level 1, 2, 3, and 4 right now. There'll be a fifth level legendary raids later. But you just see that. And, you know, for a level 1 raid, you can maybe do it on your own, 2 people. A level 2 raid, probably 2 or 3 people. A level 4 raid, some people can do it on their own, but maybe 4 or 5 people. And then for the level 4 raids, we usually have like 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people.
See, I feel like I'm at a disadvantage because I haven't played, and so I don't have the strong in a while, so I don't have the strongest Pokemon.
That's what you get from raids, though. I mean, you have a chance to get a Snorlax or a Tyranitar or a Lapras right away from winning the raid and then catching it afterwards. Yeah.
Not something to be ignored.
No, not something to be sneezed at.
And don't sneeze at that Snorlax.
No.
Let's take a break when we come back, unless anybody has something we haven't talked about you wanted to bring up. I think we've covered the big stories and quite a few of the off-topic stories. What is
We're
the name?
Humans.
Do you
we
remember, Andy, what is the name of that sous vide that I bought?
The Mellow.
It had such a great name.
I don't know. See, it was a great idea. I don't know if you wanted if a manufacturer wants to create the context routine, if it's yellow, let it mellow.
Yeah, that wasn't sure maybe the best, but I didn't think of that. Now I will. so it looks like I can order it, but when does it? Oh, last chance at early bird pricing. Oh, yeah. I was an early bird like 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So maybe we're getting close.
Fingers crossed. I would not cancel your delivery of home delivery of stuff till then, but yes.
Let's put it this way. I ordered on Amazon a bunch of silicone sous vide bags so I could reuse them and they wouldn't have any, you know, bad chemicals in them. I've lost them months ago. I don't know where they are.
The last thing I'll say about sous vide in this show is that I would not use those things because I'm
going to get a vacuum sealer.
I like to cut open the bag,
dump
the bag onto the plate, and then throw away every item that I cooked with.
Right. No dishes like to wash.
Washing out a silicone bag. I don't care about the environment to that extent. I have to do a dishwashing.
What did you like the vacuum sealer you got? Is it a food saver? What kind did you get?
It's the cheapest, like 50. It was like 50 something dollars on sale. I think it's normally like $70. The more expensive ones, actually, you don't have to use pre-made bags. You can actually load up a roll of bag material and then just peel off however much you need.
And we know that these are safe in sous vide.
I haven't been killed yet. None of the bags have melted on me yet.
You could have cancer cooking.
They've tried, Leo. They've tried.
believe. I'm getting cancer, but it's not going to be because of
this. There is a prime deal right now on the Cronova VS100 vacuum sealing system. $69.90. It's not such a great deal, though. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know about that one. But
yeah.
The great thing about vacuum seals is that it does mean that again, I'll buy like an 8-pack of hot dogs and half of them go into the freezer, or yeah. there'll be a sale on something that I like that I can't eat all in 10 days for.
Yeah,
no,
that's
bad.
A good idea. Yeah.
You bag it up and it goes, and even like just every time I'll buy some cheese, seal up in a bag, and it just now lasts effectively forever because there's no air getting into it. So that was a good buy.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like Mello's shipping this month. Unless they mean July 2018.
Even if you end up with two, Leo, you'll learn to use both of them. As Andy said, you'll just be like, oh.
Get the A-Nova, and then I'll be ready to do the Mello.
You can make them fight.
Sous vide fight. Our show today brought to you by something I am glad I purchased, and I continue to purchase more all the time at the Drobo store, of course. My lovely Drobo. And, you know, they have not sat still. Drobo was created kind of when the founder some time ago suffered a hard drive crash on his RAID array. He thought, well, I should never lose data. I'm on RAID. And he realized that RAID, as implemented on most computers these days, is not as robust as one might hope. So he created Beyond RAID and Drobos, designed to protect your important data forever. And they've got a new one. I love art. I use the Drobo Mini all the time. That's my main boot drive. I have a 5N, which is my, I use it as a network-attached storage. They've just released the 5D3. I'm very excited about this. This is their third-generation 5-bay direct-attached storage. So this is the ultimate in, high-speed storage, not a network device, but attached to your computer for people like Alex Lindsay who make massive videos, people who have a lot to back up, photographers. Thunderbolt 3, baby. USB Type-C ports, 2X performance boost. You can, because it's got Thunderbolt 3 and pass-through, it supports a 5K display or two 4K displays as pass-through. It's, of course, got all of the great Drobo features, including the accelerator bay. On all my Drobos, I buy those. You don't need a big one, a 64 gig mSATA card that you put in the bottom there, and that really speeds up reads of small files. 5D3 would be ideal for editing and storing photos and videos for your 5 and 4K workflows, backing up, of course, all your personal and business data. And it comes with a 2-year warranty. This is an awesome, awesome new Drobo. And as with all the Drobos, it's those lights on front and the magnetic panel you can pull right off that make it so easy to add drives. And the lights tell you how your drives, this is a 5-bay unit, so you see all the green lights. When you start to run out of space on one of the drives, it shows you which drive to replace, the smallest drive. Yes, you can mix drive sizes without any issue. And you just pop the small drive and you put in a bigger drive and it automatically incorporates it and you're good to go. Here's the little mSATA add-on on the bottom. When you buy the Drobo 5D3, you'll also get this beautiful skin. Look at that. Isn't that pretty? On the front, so everybody will know you've got the new Drobo. Go to drobostore.com to learn more and check out their complete line of products. They have lowered prices across the board, and you'll save an extra 10% on select Drobo models, including the Drobo 5D3, the brand new one. At drobostore.com, when you use the offer code TWIT10, TWIT and the number 10, of course, you get that great skin, too. Drobo for a limited time, while supplies last, as they say. Drobostore.com, the 5D3. You can put, what is the max? I think some ungodly amount of storage. 64 terabytes? I can't remember. Just amazing. And fast. I'm going all Thunderbolt 3. Drobo Store.
But you know that in 10 years, sorry. In 10 years, it'll be like, remember back when I bought 64 terabytes and I thought that was a lot. When I bought my 2CI, I bought 122 megabytes of hard drive space.
I know.
And someone asked, like, what are you going to do with all that space? And I'm like, I'm doing audio, man. I'm doing audio. I need that space.
I got the bits.
Yep. You got the bits. You don't want to know what we paid for our SAN. Oh my God, what a waste of money that was. Well, as long as we're talking Thunderbolt 3, can I make my pick first? I never start.
Please.
But I ordered this is another one of those things I ordered ages ago from Otherworld Computing. It's right here. It's all plugged in. It's the new new Thunderbolt 3 dock. I thought at the time there would be a lot more Macs using Thunderbolt 3 by now. I'm a little disappointed, but it does work with the 2017 iMac, and I'm using it with my 2016 MacBook Pro that has, this is the one with two Thunderbolt 3 ports, which is kind of a drag, except when I hook up the port to the Otherworld Computing dock.
All the ports.
Yeah, I get all the ports. It's plugged in, so it's powering, you know, the laptop. I've got gigabit Ethernet. I've got FireWire 800. Ooh. Alex, I bet you have a few FireWire devices still lying around. Optical video. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 USB 3.1 Type A connector ports. This is analog audio, and there's an SD card slot as well. This is a great dock. You sit down. It comes with the Thunderbolt cable, so you just sit down, and you go, oh, let's plug that in. We're driving right now, not only powering the MacBook, but we're also driving the display so that you can see the screen. It will drive a 5K display or two 4K displays. That's just the general limit on the Thunderbolt 3. You can not only connect six USB 3.1 devices, but it will charge all of them. I think it goes up to 4.2 amps. It works with your legacy FireWire storage. It's got a DAC in it, so you've got analog out and in, by the way, so you could hook up your speakers to it. I mean, this is kind of an ideal dock. $299. They announced this, I'm not kidding, a long time ago. I love Otherworld Computing stuff, and I ordered it at the time, and I just got it yesterday. So it's they still say pre-order, but I think they're shipping now. So you can get it now, and if you need, this would be for somebody like Alex or somebody who wants to use either a laptop, you know, one of the new MacBook Pros, and wants to be able to carry it around, but then sit down and have all of the connectivity and the power of a desktop, or if you have the new iMac, Thunderbolt 3 is
amazing. I just can't believe it has FireWire. I need it just for the FireWire.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people think that Thunderbolt 3 don't cut to me because I have the camera on the thing of my pick of the week, so it's going to look like a talking piece of hardware. There you go.
A talking box.
Hello. I'd like to speak on behalf of Andy. I'm a shitty burner.
And at least the light blinks in sync.
People think the Thunderbolt 3 is an Apple thing, but it's actually a brand new
from
Intel, and it's going to control everything.
I haven't tried this yet because I have a number of Windows devices that have Thunderbolt 3, and I haven't tried it. But I think you need drivers. I suspect it's not going to work, at least not fully work with a Windows device. And you don't want to use it, I think, with a Thunderbolt 2 device. I think this is really for people who have the new MacBook Pros or the new iMac.
Or the MacBook, I think. No, that's not Thunderbolt 3. It won't do it.
No, the MacBook even. Right. Yeah. Although I should try it with a MacBook. You know, I apologize. I haven't. But the way they describe it at MacSales.com, their website, is this is specifically for the new MacBook Pros and the new iMac. But I like it. I mean, if you need all that connectivity, I like it. And it charges. I've been charging.
I ordered one. I just haven't got it yet.
You should get it soon, I think. You're in Canada, yep. So maybe you'll get it in the fall. I like the FireWire. And you can daisy chain the FireWire, of course. Anyway, that's my pick of the week. If you need it, get it. Why don't you give us something, Renee?
So mine is actually self-serving, but it is time appropriate. We have a website. It's not technically part of Mobile Nations, but it's owned by the same people who own Mobile Nations, called thrifter.com. And they have just gotten a huge redesign in time for Amazon Prime Day. Ooh. And what they're doing, they're a little bit nutty. They are obsessed about deals. And they spent 30 hours live blogging. All of them have spent 30 hours live blogging Prime Day, trying to find the best deals. They're posting the ones that have a shelf life, but the other ones they're tweeting and they're just doing in the live blog. And they really care about quality and they really care about value and they really care about the sort of things that we as geeks sort of really care about. So they're doing the work of going through everything that Amazon is posting. And they do this every day, not just on Prime Day. They go through Amazon and Best Buy and they try to find what's really a good, what's really a valuable, what's really a legitimate deal. And then they just surface all of those on Twitter and on the newly redesigned thrifter.com, which is based off the same sort of technology that iMore is now based on.
And this is the Yi Cam that you recommended a while ago, Andy, which I bought and is a big deal on Prime Day. So there you go. This is good. It really helps to have something like this if you're going to buy something on Prime Day. So you do buy things that you're saving on.
Yeah, this was the brainchild of Kevin Michaluk, who pays way too much money for stuff. And he said, there's no way for me to stop buying, so I just want to get the best price when I do.
Very nice. Thrifter.com. Andy, you have a box on your desk.
Yes, this is my brand new CD, DVD, Blu-ray drive. And yes, you're going to think, why does anybody on earth need an optical drive? Well, because I use it almost entirely just to ingest CDs and DVDs and Blu-rays into my my media library. And I've had, you can sort of see them in the corner of the screen. I had an original Apple DVD slot drive, and I had like this cheap, like eBay Chinese $35 Blu-ray reader that I was using for that kind of stuff. And for some reason, occasionally a CD wouldn't come in and a Blu-ray or a DVD wouldn't be able to rip with my usual ripping tools. And I was like, oh my God, I hope they haven't changed the security levels so that now my software can't do it. Thank God it was just I had bad hardware. So I went shopping around for a replacement. This is the one that I settled on, the Pioneer BDR XD05, available in both black and shiny silver. And it's a Blu-ray and DVD and CD reader and writer. It cost me about $90 at B&H Photo. That's about the running price for it, pretty much wherever you go. But it operates off of USB 3. A lot of the cheaper drives you will get have like those old fashioned pair of USB connectors in the back, one for power, one for whatever. This is full USB 3 speed and power. Really slim. It's a top loader. I wish it were a slot loader, but whatever. But the deal is that it does work with all of the apps that I use to convert CDs and movie discs into files I can put onto my file server. And fast, fast, fast. Because I've never had a need, I don't have a real need day-to-day for CDs, for software and stuff like that. I forgot that like USB 3 is faster than USB 2. So that's why exactly it's like one more, isn't it? Yes. But that's the reason why I've got like my webcam on a little tabletop tripod showing you this, because I started ripping Hot Fuzz.
Need a copy of that, I think. Yes.
It's a great. Oh, for a second. So it's a winner
classic.
Movie.
It's a classic.
It's part of the Cornetto trilogy.
I know. All of which I hate. But go ahead.
Okay, that's fine.
No, I like the zombie one. That was a good one.
There you go. Shaun of the Dead again.
Shaun of the Dead. Yeah,
that's fine. You're entitled to your completely.
Does this work with a Mac?
Yes, that's what I've got it hooked up to.
So
now,
this bag of hurt you can hang off a Mac.
It's not a bag of hurt. It's a top-loading wedge of awesomeness, meaning that obviously it's not going to – if you drop a DVD in it, it'll play the DVD using the built-in Mac software. Blu-rays, of course, it'll mount as a storage volume, but you won't be able to play it because the Mac doesn't come with that software. If you pair it with software that can convert DVDs and Blu-rays into movies, you will find that this works perfectly great with all that and does it really fast. Like I said, the reason why I'm not holding it up in front of my beautiful face is because I've been ripping CDs, movies with it for the past 2 or 3 days, and I actually kind of thought it would be done by now, but it's not. So I have to keep it. I don't want to start it all over again. So because I really want to see this movie tonight. But yeah, so you might be worried about if you're using again these third-party tools that convert movies. Maybe it won't be compatible with this app or that app. All the ones that you might have heard of, all the ones that Jason Snell has written about on Six Colors. He's written a couple of really good guides on how to convert movies to regular QuickTime files. Those work with all those apps. And so this is a good tried and true. Again, not the cheapest one you can get, but it is a Pioneer drive. It's really, really well done. And you don't get a piece of junk. So that's why I bought it. And that's why I'm recommending it.
Very nice.
If you're a nerd, you can go to github.com/Don Melton and check out all of Don's tools for H.264 and I think starting soon, 65.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's his endeavor after making Safari. He's just ripping out the DVDs.
It's going to get so much better. This is why like I don't buy digital movies. I buy them on disc because I feel like that way I'm buying like an installer master disc, and when an even better compression method comes along, the ones that I really care about, I don't know, like maybe Star Wars, really good new movies. I'll just simply spend the time to re-rip them into the new format and have them on my Plex server. I remember I had my pick of the week a few weeks ago was the Synology, an upgraded to my Synology NAS, and that's part of what's spurring this on. Now I've got a whopping 8 terabytes of storage. And it's like now that I've got five terabytes of free storage. Why was I so conservative in ripping those movies before? Why don't I re-rip them at much higher quality? So.
Our pick of the weeks continue with Alex Lindsay.
So I inherited in the house that I moved into. I inherited a lot of Sonos equipment.
Wow!
When we were looking at the house, I was like, "Is that going to stay here?" You know,
was
they
it
were like,
built in?
Yeah. So there's wiring that goes through the house.
Oh, so they can't take
so,
it.
I guess it wasn't seen useful. I mean, you could. I mean, there was speaker wire like run everywhere. I guess that's whoever built the original house was an AV contractor. Right, so there's Cat 5 and speaker wire and all kinds of stuff. And but I didn't.
I'd have bought the house just for that.
It is why I signed it. My wife had a bunch of other reasons.
Like, oh yeah.
You know, it's a really nice house, and
let's
I was like,
your priorities straight.
Server room. I mean, it's got a server room. You know, and so anyway . And I have to admit that I got some Sonos speaker, and I just never really took to it. You know, it was like one of those things that I was excited about and just had a lot of trouble setting it up, you know, years ago or whatever, and decided, oh, it's okay. But what I have to say is that I'm making it my pick because I finally got over that hump and just sat down and like, I got to figure this out. And, you know, it's a lot of different rooms and so on and so forth. And it just works great, you know, because it ties into Spotify and you just sit there and just go, I want to listen to this playlist in this room. And it just, you know, it just works, you know, getting it set up was much easier than I thought, which was because I had to reset it all, you know, somebody else's Sonos.
Right.
So,
but Sonos is amazing. As their new slogan says, it really ties the room together, man.
and it was just. It's so easy to set up.
I worry about them. I have to say, with Apple's new Home Hub and all these companies going into kind of Google's stuff can also sync together. I worry that Sonos is falling behind. They never had voice activation, and they still don't.
Well, and I guess for me, you know, those don't make much. I mean, the speakers aren't really what I have there. These are all Kinects and Kinect amps.
Oh, so you have them connected to real stereos.
There's real speakers in all the left behind in the house too. And so they're an outside and the, you know.
What I do. I have the Kinects and I have them connected to stereo systems.
Right. And there's, you know, and in this case, there's, you know, like a lot of them. So there was a lot of.
Did you go out and buy a bunch of them or they had the Kinects?
No, they were there.
They were all there. Because these are $350 bucks each for a Sonos Kinect. That's basically gives the wireless portion of the Sonos to your speakers, your stereo system. But you have to have a stereo system to use it.
Exactly. There were a couple of Kinects and then there were a bunch of Kinect amps. And
amps work with the unpowered speakers.
You just plug speakers into them and off they go. And so that's what I have. I mean, I don't I have one or two. I have the speakers that I bought, the little Sonos speakers that I finally added to the system. But the ones that are there, and I just have to say that if you're thinking about doing something like that where you're going to control a bunch of pieces, I mean, and I think you think a lot of us that are kind of really into this are thinking, oh, I'm going to use the I want to use my stereo. These Kinects and the Kinect, and if you don't have a stereo, the Kinect amps are pretty great little
boxes. They work really well, yeah. And they have optical out, so you can go, you know, optical and everything. No, I use them. Both my stereo systems have Sonos Kinects attached. I never thought about the amp. So you can get some.
Yeah, the amp.
I mean, the Sonos speakers themselves are pretty good.
I mean, but this is like there's a bunch of speakers and things, you know, and it's stereo and
the amp costs the same as their Play 5. But I guess if you have better speakers than the Play 5, it would make sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're trying to tie it back into something you already have some speakers, you already have a stereo system and you want to have that be just something easy to go. And again, being able to say, I want to group, you know,
that's the real advantage. Party
mode. I have people coming over. Yeah. So I want the outside yard and I want the living room and the kitchen all to have the same music playing. And it was surprisingly easy. Again, I didn't really take to it the first time I got into it, but it's great. It's a great little package.
Yeah, I agree. It's very elegant.
And I have them, you know, I have all that stuff in the house too. You know, My I have to admit the I don't know how you've been the show. Have you been using the show?
I am such a fan of the show. Did you get a show?
Yeah, my kids have forgotten that Google. So before I had a Dot and I had the whatever, and I had the Google Home, and the kids were all, they didn't really like the Skella, and they all they use is Google Home for whatever.
Call it Echo if you would, so we don't trigger people.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So the Echo and so anyway, and so they always were asking Google something, and as soon as it took like about a half a day for the show to be out. Before they had completely decided that the screen was super cool, and they're like, "We just need to take this. We can just take this anywhere and just plug it in." Yep. And we've got movies and we've got things. And like my son was like, his head was like, "This is amazing! Like we can just do all these things with this thing." And I was just like, "He already knows it way better than I do."
It's, you know, like he's pretty got darn all cool.
Out. Yeah. They're asking him stuff all the time, and kids are just. That's what I'm really seeing is how quickly kids will. I mean, like us when we were kids.
Yeah.
But they just absorb the technology so seamlessly, and then immediately are just using it every day like it always existed.
Yeah, I have quite a few of them now. I have as bad an Echo habit as I do a Sonos habit. Eventually, this is one something's got to give.
Yeah. Right.
Alex Lindsay's at the Pixel Core, pixelcore.com. And, of course, if you follow him on Twitter, A-L-E-X-L-I-N-D-S-A-Y, you'll keep up with all the things he does. He does a lot of kind of surprise seminars and things. So follow him on Twitter.
And I'm going to be doing some – I'm going to go on a bit of a tour over the late summer and fall to meet people. So I'm going to be doing – so I'll be posting on Twitter, and I'll be giving you actually more than a day of warning that where I'm going to be. So.
Nice.
As I slowly do less and less production because we have so many great people working here, so I'm able to get out a little bit more.
Thank you for being here, and happy birthday! Yesterday was Alex's birthday. Happy birthday! Ooh. Andy Iannacco's at the Chicago Sun Times joins us every week. It's always a pleasure to have you on, sir.
Thank you very much. Gives me a good excuse to be awake by 2 p.m. Very handy.
Anything you'd like to plug?
There's a multi-part piece that might be going up on my blog on Monday. It depends on how soon I can get it out of copy edit. It's something kind of big. Big in terms of size as opposed to necessarily this will break the internet in half as every Marvel press release tends to say.
we'll look for it and we'll talk about it next Tuesday on Mac Break Weekly. Rene Ritchie, imore.com. He's got to go Pokemon, I'm sure. Thank you.
Not just yet.
No, you got a little time? Okay.
Yes, sir.
imore.com, at Rene Ritchie. Anything you'd like to plug?
I don't have anything Andy Iannacco, Kim Kardashian bottom internet breaking size to report, but we're doing a lot of good stuff about what may or may not be in the next generation iPhone on iMore. So just keep it locked.
Good. Yeah. So we could have talked more about that.
Sure. Next time.
Keep
wanting more.
Yep. This will be dragging out until September anyway.
Until release. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We do Mac Break Weekly every Tuesday about 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. That's 1800 UTC. I have a lovely studio audience today. From all over. Thank you so much for coming. If you want to be in our studio audience, just email tickets at twit.tv. We love having people visit us. You can also visit us on the internet at twit.tv/live. Watch the show live. And if you do that, please join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. You can back talk during the show. Always welcome. But if you can't be here live or watch live, there is another way. On-demand versions of everything we do are available at our website, twit.tv. And for this show, it's twit.tv/mbw. And you can also use your favorite podcast appliance and subscribe. By the way, we work great on the Amazon Echo. All you have to do is ask if you want to listen live or watch live if you have an Echo show. All you have to do is ask for Twit Live. Sometimes I have to say Twit Live. which is fine with me. Twit Live on, I think, on TuneIn. And of course, you can listen to individual podcasts there as well. Thanks for being here. But now, my friends, time to get back to work because, you know, break time is over.